The Pentagon just cranked Israel's counterintelligence threat level all the way up to critical, the highest designation, right there with our worst adversaries. U.S. officials are now using burner phones and staying tight-lipped in hotel rooms when they visit Israel because the Israelis are aggressively spying on top Trump administration people, digging for inside dope on decisions about Iran and Lebanon. This isn't some rogue operation. It's all coordinated, hyper-aggressive espionage from our so-called closest ally. Jonathan Pollard-style damage from the past should have been a warning, but here we are again. Americans are rightly asking how an ally that spies on us at this level gets treated like family.
With me, I don't care if you start throwing nukes immediately, responsibly, but immediately. And a case that I've been pushing is the use of an electromagnetic pulse weapon or weapons against Iran. Why are we waiting to get hit?
That's Jonathan Pollard, the most famous Israeli spy in modern history, who sold out our secrets, got our agents killed, you name it. He sold to the Russians, the Chinese, the Israelis, everybody. And remember, Trump pardoned him back at the end of his first administration. So now Israel's funding will be within the Pentagon in joint weapons development, but they're going to be allowed into everything and be able to claim co-ownership of the U.S. military-industrial complex that Eisenhower told us to beware, the technological elite that control the military-industrial complex. So think about that. Then you've got 38 states that have passed laws or executive orders that if you criticize Israel anyway, or ever boycott Israel, or criticize Zionism, or what happened in Gaza, these are laws that you cannot have any government contracts or government jobs. Totally illegal, unconstitutional tyranny. And that's because Israel admits they're moving their weapons industries here to the United States. And so now if you criticize anything Israel's doing, you're shut down by the state governments, violating our First Amendment. You add that with the NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, you got to read that for yourself. Total lifetime fusion integration of everything, from academia to DARPA to MIT to secret weapons development to live intelligence, telemetry, weapons guidance, weapons systems, everything. Remember, the other agencies don't even let each other know what they're doing. The other armed services branches are in competition and let them have their secrets. And that's good to keep things compartmentalized. This is, Congress doesn't even know 10% of what the Pentagon's up to. This is Israel's coup against America.
The real gut punch is what's happening in Congress at the exact same time. On the heels of the revelation of Section 224 slowly advancing, Senator Tom Cotton slipped Section 622 into the FY27 Intelligence Authorization Act. This thing locks America into permanent unbreakable intelligence entanglement with Israel. It mandates expanded sharing, ties it to Israel's qualitative military edge, restricts the president or future Congress from scaling it back without jumping through huge legal hoops and notifying bought and paid for committees, and even pushes sharing with Abraham Accords countries. There will be no unwinding this. We are looking at intel fusion as a pillar of policy, handing over leverage that could bite us hard if relations sour. We'll find ourselves either towing the line for Israel or facing serious consequences. Meanwhile, the Pentagon flags Israel as a top spy threat, and lawmakers are wiring them deeper into our system. This isn't partnership. It's a one-way street that smells like foreign influence money run amok. America first means putting our sovereignty and secrets ahead of any foreign lobby. It's not optional, and it's a major insult on this 250th anniversary of our nation. John Bound reporting for the Alex Jones Network at alexjoneslive.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bigley has launched an online pharmacy, 1776rx.health. It's one product we're launching with my decision, and that is ivermectin with benbenzidol, both powerful really good anti-parasitics. It doesn't just get the big worms and all the crap that's out there. It's amoebas, it's microplasms. It is so important. These two together, I mean, ivermectin is a Nobel Prize winning for this, but minbenzidol is the big one. And folks, it isn't just parasites. Just search minbenzidol studies. Just put that into a search engine and you'll see congressional hearings. You'll see top scientists. You'll see all the studies on what else it does that they don't want you to know about. It's dramatic. So, and you won't know if you had any type of parasitical deal or whatever until you've done this. And a lot of people went there yesterday. A lot of people got it. Very smart move. 1776rx.health.
You're watching The War Room with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now on X.com.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to War Room Live. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, coming to you live this Tuesday afternoon, the 25th of August, 2026. Of course, share the link, AlexJonesLive.com. Find us on Rumble, rumble.com/The War Room Live. We have a lot to cover today. Obviously, developments across the board. The Iran war, the Ukraine-Russia war, the data centers, the flock, the threat of China, all coming up on today's show. We're going to start today with the tragic news, the passing of Dolly Parton. Because as much as we despise and rightfully talk trash about the current state of America, it's also worth it to point out those few people who still lived up to the American ideal, and Dolly Parton was certainly one of those. This is the announcement of her passing from Brian Seaver. Clip number 29. Here is his announcement and statement about the passing of Dolly Parton. Let's watch.
You said that. Don't
clip 29. This is the wrong one, guys. Clip 29. Brian Seaver announces his passing. All right, we got the wrong video up. Also the wrong one, but not as far wrong. Not as wrong that time. We do have Dolly Parton here. I'm also not her day. I think we may have some trouble. Technical difficulties. Well, let me know when we can play that video. But in case you're not familiar with just some of Dolly Parton's charitable activities. Windigoon on X at Windigoon 8. Dolly Parton was born in East Tennessee and used her success to make it better. So much money from her attractions and fame came into our mountain communities and was put into schools and infrastructure. She made the Imagination Library to help childhood literacy in Appalachia every month since our daughter was born. The library sent her a book with a note from Dolly encouraging her to be proud of where she's from and to learn the importance of the stories that built us. Her husband passed last year and she spoke of being reunited with him. I'm glad heaven is a little sweeter and sings a little better for it. Rest in peace, the Queen of Appalachia. Jolene could never achieve what Dolly Parton did. And again, there's just a sense of, and I've been seeing it too, you know, people posting videos of Dolly Parton where she seems to make a hand signal that's satanic in certain circumstances, or pointing out that she pushed the COVID vaccine. I'm going to be the first to tell you right now, Dolly Parton gets a pass. All right. She gets a pass. All right. She pushed the COVID vaccine because she loves helping people and she was misled, and we forgive her for that because she deserves it. But seriously, she just evinces this spirit of like noblesse oblige, of like actually building up the place you came from and actually, you know, succeeding elsewhere, but always returning home to make her success not something she enjoyed alone, but something that benefited everybody from where she was. So again, guys, we can get that clip 29. I do want to play that just so we can get the full announcement. Okay, so this is her longtime security guard and member of her family announcing the passing of Dolly Parton. Let's watch.
Hey, everyone. My name is Brian Seaver, son of Cassie Parton, and I am representing the Parton and Owens family today, announcing the passing of my Aunt Dolly, Rebecca Parton Dean, sister, sis, aunt granny to one generation and Gigi to the next. This video announcement is something Dolly asked of me years ago, before I fully absorbed it as a future reality. As her head of security for more than two decades, a role my father Larry held before me, I have imagined the heaviness of this moment, but haven't truly felt it until now. It is an honor that is mixed with absolute pride and great sadness. But sadness lies with us, not with Dolly. Dolly has lived in the light and is in the arms of Jesus, surely met by Carl, her parents, and countless others who have watched her and longed for her to meet them in the heavens. I first went on the road with Dolly as a kid, getting a taste of the road life in the early 1980s. Dolly opened doors not just for me, but for her entire family to reach the potential we didn't even know was possible. Dolly also opened doors for generations of singers, songwriters, musicians, and dreamers from every walk of life and across every continent. By her example, we believed that anything was possible. She never saw a door she couldn't open, and the doors she opened made and changed history. My family and I have shared a lifetime of beautiful memories with Dolly, but so have you. She has always been on your television, your record player, your CD, and on your phone playlist, becoming an extended part of your family whether you liked it or not. Our family and the team she has entrusted with her legacy will work diligently to ensure her spirit will live with us forever. Dolly was a farmer, just like her daddy. He farmed the soil, she farmed songs and happiness. Dolly called me and said she wants to rest in a beautiful bed of plush cotton because after a life wearing heavy rhinestones, she finally deserves to be comfortable and have some rest. Rest in peace, Aunt Dolly, Aunt Granny, Gigi. May God bless Dolly Parton, and may God bless you all. She will always love you.
There you go. She passed away at age 80. This was written up by a ex-user named Anash Munka. And it just tells you what the last 80 years was like in America. The doctor who delivered Dolly Parton in a one-room Tennessee cabin in 1946 was paid with a sack of cornmeal. Her father farmed other people's land and could not read or write. 80 years later, the reading program she built in his name has mailed more than 300 books. She wrote I Will Always Love You on the same afternoon she wrote Jolene as a goodbye to Porter Wagoner and released it in 1974. Elvis wanted it. The night before the session, Colonel Tom Parker called and said Presley would only record it if they got half the publishing, meaning half of everything the song ever earned. She had been in Nashville 10 years by then. She said no and cried all night. Whitney Houston cut her version in 1992, held number one for 14 weeks, and Forbes later put Parton's royalties from it near $10 million. She put some of that money into an office complex in Nashville and called the place the house that Whitney built. Dollywood opened in Pigeon Forge in 1986 because she wanted paychecks in the county she came from. Around 4,000 people work there now. 3 million visitors come every year. University of Tennessee put its economic impact at $1.8 billion, and it's the largest employer in Sevier County. Since 2022, the company has paid tuition, fees, and books in full for every worker from their first day, seasonal hires included. Wildfires tore through those mountains in November 2016, killing 14 people and destroying more than 2,400 buildings. Her foundation was handing out money within 48 hours. Every family that lost a home got $1,000 a month for 6 months, regardless of income. The final check was $5,000, total delivered $8.9 million. In April 2020, she sent $1 million to Vanderbilt for coronavirus research. When Moderna's vaccine results ran in the New England Journal of Medicine that November, her fund appeared in the footnotes. Carl D., which we forgive her for, which she gets a pass for, because she's just trying to help people. She was misaligned there, and that's okay. I mean, it's not okay, but we forgive her. Carl Dean, her husband of nearly 60 years, died in March 2025. The note she wrote to fans afterwards ended with the same five words wrote for Porter Wagoner back in 1974. She died in Nashville today. Her family asked that instead of flowers, people give to the Imagination Library, which still mails 3.4 million books a month to children who will never get to meet her. So again, you know, as crappy as our current crop of so-called elites are, it's worth remembering, or now I guess mourning, the passing of one of the real ones. And by the way, if you're not familiar, I mean, it's like half the songs on the top 100 charts for like decades were all written by her. Like songs you had no idea, like Willie Nelson, you know, his number one hits that she wrote, and obviously Whitney Houston. I mean, she was really a prolific genius in a lot of ways. So we'll move on now. We will move on. But the passing of one of the last few, like, I don't know, in my opinion, respectable, decent people in Hollywood ever, like, just really, really makes a stark appearance when you go from Dolly Parton to whatever the hell we have now. I don't even want to say their names. Not in the same sentence with Dolly. Yeah, totally, totally tragic, but we will move on. We'll move on now, although we'll be playing her songs intermittently throughout the show. But we do have a lot more to talk about and a lot to get into, of course, with everything going around today. And it looks like, you know, what's happening right now with the Trump administration would have been amazing in the first couple of months of his administration. And if this energy had continued, and it really does seem like they're just like getting serious about it now. Seems like maybe because of the threat of midterms going the way of the Democrats, they're actually trying to do things now, which is kind of pathetic. Should have been doing this the entire time. I'm not trying to, you know, undercut things, but again, the metaphor, and I perceive all of this, you know, fitting perfectly into, it's like the battle at Helm's Deep, and it's like you can point to, you know, Gandalf coming over the ridge and be like, he killed a dozen goblins. He killed a dozen orcs. Like, isn't that something? Shouldn't you be happy? Stop saying he didn't do anything. A dozen orcs, that's a lot. And it's like, okay, yeah, it kind of is, but there's like several thousand that need to be taken care of. Like, that's not enough. It's just not enough. So when the stakes are your survival, not enough is death. So, like, what are we doing here? And why did it take this long for this type of stuff to actually kick into gear? You have things like Trump admin revoking up to 200,000 short-term visas for visitors who overstayed and then sought asylum. The Trump administration is reportedly set to revoke up to 200,000 business and tourism visas from people who are seeking or have applied for asylum status in the United States, making the move the largest single mass revocation of visas in U.S. history if it moves forward. Which, again, it's like, okay, sounds good. Biggest mass revocation of visas in American history. That's got to count for something, right? Except we brought over something like 1.1 million people in a year under these visas. So 200,000 is only a fifth of those. So again, you know, not to downplay what is actually happening, but it's not enough. And I'm not satisfied, and nobody should be. Trump also has proposed a new fee of $103,265 for H-1B visas that would apply to most new applicants, not just those applying from abroad. Details include this new H-1B proposal would include those already in the U.S., and a number of new visas each year would be capped at 85,000. Still seems like a lot. Universities, hospitals, and other nonprofit institutions are exempted from the cap. Okay, so it's not great. The new fee would supersede the $100,000 fee President Trump announced last year, which was struck down by a federal appeals court. The tech sector is expected to be the most heavily impacted by this policy change. So again, good. It's good. It certainly is good. Just not enough. It's just not enough. That's all I can say about it. Let's go now to clip number 27. DHS and HSI identify more than 10,000 foreign students linked to suspected nationwide OPT employer fraud. So this is like the college version of H-1B visas. Let's go now to clip number 27. This is the official announcement of the fraud bust about the OPT visas. Let's watch.
Information provided to DHS. Under the Biden administration, the fraud escalated even further. Today we are announcing that we have identified over 10,000 foreign students who claim to be working for highly suspect employers. And that's just among the top 25 OPT employers. This is only the tip of the iceberg. Over the past year, we've dramatically expanded our oversight of OPT and can report that we've found fraud nationwide. HSI agents have visited problematic OPT employer work sites in Virginia, Texas, Georgia, Illinois, New York, New Jersey, North Carolina, and Florida. Many of these employers include NGOs engaged in suspicious activity. We've discovered empty buildings and locked doors at addresses where hundreds of foreign students are allegedly employed. In many cases, multiple OPT employers claim to operate from the same address, but none actually lease the facility. We found small residential addresses listed as work sites for hundreds of foreign students, yet no employees were present. When someone does answer the door, their statements are inconsistent, or they claim no knowledge of the business. We're also seeing financial red flags. Many alleged employers display clear fraud indicators, including tax liens, civil lawsuits, collections, and breaches of contract. And we are seeing suspicious financial transactions moving cash across multiple countries. We've discovered that numerous businesses fail to maintain basic employment records for the foreign students, raising serious tax reporting concerns. Some employers claim to have offshore human resources and payroll personnel. And finally, we're finding what we call phantom employees. We've identified foreign students who obtained work authorization documents through OPT, but never showed up for work at the sites they claimed. While we can't share details of ongoing investigations, I can assure you that more information is forthcoming and that we are taking this fraud very seriously. With that, I'll turn it over to the Acting Executive Associate Director for HSI, Mr. John Condon, who can speak in greater detail. John.
Thank you, Director Lyons. Last week, HSI investigators and compliance officials conducted site visits at 18 OPT work sites in North Texas. Our findings were alarming. We discovered coordinated employer clusters where numerous employers in the same building complex are running nearly identical websites, sharing job postings and management personnel, but claiming no business relationships with each other. We found shell company schemes where multiple OPT employers are established by the same owner-operator, indicating a deliberate scheme to structure income and evade taxes. We have encountered employers who claim only a handful of OPT employees, despite our records showing that hundreds of students claim to work there. To give you an example, one employer we visited claimed to employ only 3 foreign students through OPT, while our records show over 500 foreign students claiming to work there. The company's representatives were unable to answer basic questions about the business and deferred to HR managers in India. OPT employers are required to directly train foreign students, but we've seen multiple examples of alleged employers claiming that all management is overseas in India. We've also discovered multiple state networks which are large networks of alleged employers claiming to train thousands of foreign students in OPT, then farming them out to unreported third-party employers, making oversight nearly impossible and raising serious national security issues. And we found potential evidence of international financial fraud. Our investigators have discovered questionable financial networks crossing multiple countries involving numerous bank accounts and complex transactions. These cases aren't limited by geography. In Houston, we found an alleged OPT employer accused of pay-to-stay visa fraud who was charging students under the table to help them fraudulently maintain visa status. The phony employer had never operated from the listed address, and over 100 foreign students allegedly employed there were nowhere to be found. In Georgia, we found an alleged IT company's address was nothing but a P.O. box. The owner operated a second related company across the street, also allegedly employing dozens of foreign students. The location was empty. One of the company's websites was flagged by DHS firewalls as potential malware, a common marker of fraudulent OPT employers. In New Jersey, we discovered an OPT employer who claimed to employ over 150 foreign students but couldn't answer basic questions about who they were or what they were hired to do. We only encountered one of these students who revealed he had not worked for the listed company in over a year. He was instead being trained by a company based in India. And in a New York condo allegedly housing dozens of foreign students, a supposed employer became visibly upset and denied any knowledge of the company, despite DHS records and student reports confirming otherwise. A foreign student confirmed the individual was the owner but could not explain his denial. HSI will continue to investigate these cases, among several others. Director Lyons.
Thank you, John. Let me be clear. Foreign students themselves are entering false addresses, employer names into the student and exchange visitor information system. But we are uncovering evidence of organized fraud that spans national and international borders. This is not accidental. It is deliberate, coordinated, and criminal. DHS will relentlessly investigate, disrupt, and refer for prosecution anyone who exploits our programs. We've intensified our vetting at consular posts overseas, targeting trafficking, forced labor, document fraud, and unauthorized employment among student visa applicants. I commend our HSI agents and support staff for their unwavering commitment to defending the integrity of the student and exchange visitor program. This fraud is not victimless. It is a blatant attack on the goodwill of the American people who generously allow foreign nationals access to our education system. If you're an employer or a foreign student engaged in fraud against the United States, you are advised to return home or surrender immediately. The criminal, civil, and immigration consequences for fraud are severe and unavoidable. We will not tolerate abuse of our programs, and more actions are forthcoming. Thank you.
You know, at a certain point, it seems like when the entire system is rife with fraud at every level, everywhere you look, let's just get rid of it. Let's get rid of that whole system. What is the upside? The upside is a bunch of foreigners get to benefit from coming over here and working. Not actually or going to school. Not actually really a benefit for America. The only way you could possibly claim it would be a benefit for America was, for one thing, you're attracting talent, which not really necessary. Not when you have so many people here in America who are being deliberately excluded from paths that lead to careers and prosperity. So I don't even, you know, first of all, care about that or think it's a valid excuse. The only people that really benefit, or it's the universities themselves who get the money from the foreign students, but is that who we want to be supporting? The university system that has been the engine of all of the terrible ideas that are tearing us apart at every pass? You know, it's like when Trump was saying, you know, if we don't have these 600,000 Chinese students, then the universities will fail. It's like, you're good. No, that's good. They should fail. They are bad and they should fail. Like, that's not a bad thing. So, okay, in the sort of pro and con categories, the pros are we keep the leftist communist university system well supplied with foreigners. Not even sure that's a pro. But on the con side, clearly massive amounts of fraud. And also all of the things that I said about the pro side, because those are actually cons. Actually keeping American universities funded with foreign money so they could keep indoctrinating our children with propaganda. Not actually a great thing. Bringing in a bunch of foreigners to our country to take spots in our university, also not a good thing. The fraud that comes along with it, not a good thing. The whole thing is bad. So let's just get rid of the whole damn thing. And I'm glad that this is being treated as a fraud investigation. I assume that means these people are going to jail, not just having their visas revoked, right? Is that going to happen? Are the teachers who were running these pay-to-play schemes where they were helping students to defraud the immigration system in exchange for cash, are they all going to be rotting in prison? If so, we'd love to see it. We'd love to see the perp walks. We'd love to see the mugshots. Are you throwing these people in prison? Because if not, then still not enough. So the Trump administration seems to be getting serious about some things here in this late hour, but how serious are they really? And is this just a band-aid so you'll vote for him again? That's the question.
Listen, right now at thealexjonesstore.com, when you buy our ultramethylene blue, the very best, it's so good for your cells, instant energy, cleans out your body. It is the most amazing product we've got at thealexjonesstore.com. You get a bottle of ultramethylene red, proprietary product that supercharges it, but acts great on its own with it. So buy the methylene blue, get the methylene red capsules, absolutely free, a huge value at thealexjonesstore.com. Now, I had them dig up from March when I first took this methylene blue a few years ago on air, and what it did, blowing away any methylene blue I ever took. Here it is.
Now, decades ago, we looked at selling you methylene blue. The problem is you couldn't get pharmaceutical grade. It was something nobody knew about. Now, because the world's awakened to it, there's a bunch of pharmaceutical grade makers of it. My doctors, medical doctor at clinics all over the state, said you need to get on methylene blue. Told me how to buy it online. Said be sure and get USP, which means pharmaceutical grade. I take it here and there. Feels like you're plugged into electricity. It gives you really clean energy. And I thought, yeah, this is great. You know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is the HHS head. He talks about how great it is. He takes a whole bunch of it. Wouldn't take three droppers like he does, even the weak stuff. So we've had the new Methylene Blue in, now available at thealexshowstore.com, for about a week. And I already had mine. And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure it's all USP. I'm sure it's great. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'll remember to take, you know, mine, which is another brand my doctor recommended. And then yesterday at about 3 o'clock, I'm watching him shoot B-roll for our new Methylene Blue that's from one of the top makers in the United States that supplies the big box stores that have it and sell it for $10 more than we do. It's a big bottle, too. Ultra Methylene Blue, the highest grade strength USP. I take a dropper and put it in my iced tea. I drink it. And I'm not a placebo guy. I'm like, okay, I'm taking Methylene Blue before I figure out. You know, the one my doctor told me to get, I'm sure. You know, sure, we'll see if it's as good. 15 minutes later, I feel my hair on my body standing up, and I feel actually an electric current in my through my fingers, in my hands, and running up my back. And I start, I'll be honest, start itching, and I go take my shirt off and look at the mirror because I'm itching, and my skin wasn't like hives. It wasn't a rash. My skin turned red. Not bright red, but red. I already got, you know, I tan easily. It's a little bit of Native American in me, so I've always got a little bit of a tan anyways. Even if I'm not getting any sun, I'm still a little bit of a tan. But it was like, I was like glowing. I was like, what the? And Chase guy was like, yeah. And he looks like a mad scientist. I'm like, I've been taking a lot of it. His hair's like, ah. And I'm like, okay. And then I swear on my children, okay? Do not take the full dose, because I drank half the glass, put it down, was busy, forgot to drink the rest, and didn't drink the other half. I was still sitting here this morning, because I'm sitting around here doing work when I drank it. And it's insane. So it would take hours to go into why it's so amazing. It is just beyond spectacular. And by the way, we're going to have one that comes out that isn't flavored. The guys thought it was great. It's all natural, organic. You know, it's just pure vanilla and mint from the mint plant, oil, essential oil in it. So it doesn't taste bad. It actually tastes good. I'm a kind of guy that likes my medicine to taste bad for whatever reason. Seems like it's better if it is, but this is the purest, strongest, and the only one out there that has natural, delicious flavoring in it. So it's amazing. Who came up with that? The vanilla and mint, it's delicious.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a war room. Mourning the passing of perhaps the last great American celebrity who truly represented the values and morals of America. Didn't just wear America as a costume. Which is how most of Hollywood treats America. Especially the parts of America that they genuinely despise, but they love putting on the costume, don't they? They put on the costume, they dress themselves up like they're cowboys and southerners or from the backwoods of Tennessee, so that you're more amenable to it when they talk to you about dismantling this whole corrupt system. I'm a down-home Tennessee boy just like you, and don't you hate Christianity like me? Don't you also think that it just makes sense that transgenders get to play in the sport they choose. Isn't that Christian of us? So we celebrate Dolly for being the real thing and not just an actor playing the part to subvert the very morals they pretend to espouse. Where to even go from here? Where to even begin our real coverage today? Because everything is insane. We'll start with Iran, I suppose, and we'll see how far we get, because everything can be sort of tied back to this. And, of course, we have, you know, Donald Trump declaring victory again today. So it is Groundhog's Day. We are stuck in this loop. I don't know what we need to do to get out of it. I don't know how we need to bash the jukebox to get the record to stop from skipping, but it's still skipping. We're still hearing the same thing over and over. But it's not going so well. It's really, and you know how you know it's not going so well is because our strategy now is economic warfare. Now, I don't know if I need to tell you this, but we were already doing that before. You know, it doesn't make much sense to be waging economic war against Iran for years on end, decades on end, you could even say. That doesn't have the effect that we want. In fact, it seemed to, in a lot of ways, blow back in our faces. Because it turns out that Iran, when they were denied, you know, access to the global market, ended up developing a lot of the technology and infrastructure to manufacture things themselves, which made them, you know, more self-sufficient, which means they can last longer in this drawn-out war of attrition. But it, you get that it doesn't make any sense to go from economic warfare to full-fledged actual bombs-dropping warfare and then back to economic warfare. Like, this is being presented as if this is a step forward. Like, this is, okay, you know, now we've done the warfare. Now we are going to pile on with the economic warfare. This is another step of our plan. It's just like, no, this is what you were doing before. It didn't work. Then you went to actual war. Also didn't work. So now you're doing the first thing that didn't work, hoping that it works now. This is nonsense. This is all nonsense. From Hormuz letter, this is from today. These stories are all from today and yesterday. The U.S. has proposed canceling the new Operation Economic Outcast, lifting all sanctions, and ending the U.S. blockade in exchange for Iran opening the Strait of Hormuz and stopping all attacks by its proxies, per Al Arabiya, citing a senior source on a new separate offer conveyed by Pakistan. Iran's conditions, however, remain unchanged. $300 billion in U.S. compensation, complete lifting of all U.S. sanctions, release of all Iranian frozen assets, $100 to $123 billion. In the U.S. naval blockade, U.S. troop withdrawal from the entire region and a comprehensive regional ceasefire, including Lebanon and Gaza. So again, this would represent an absolute and total victory for Iran. At least that's my perception. And so we're probably not going to accept it, but it would be actually a fairly convenient way out at this point. We'd get the Strait of Hormuz opened back up. We'd actually be able to get out of the Middle East for the first time in my life. It would actually be better for everybody, which is how you know it's not going to happen. Iran is reviewing an invitation to join Mecca Joint Defense Agreement signed by Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. Mehdi Rahimi, the head of the Iranian Parliament Official News Agency, said in an interview with Al Mayadeen. Rahimi said Iran had received an invitation to join the agreement and was currently considering the proposal. He also praised the efforts of states in West Asia to create a regional security umbrella, saying Iran has long advocated for such an initiative. So I await the apologies from everybody who told us that this war with Iran was necessary to defeat the Muslims, because the Muslims are our enemy. And it doesn't matter whether the action is strategically aligned to actually diminish the power of Islam. We just have to attack them because Islam. I mean, this was pretty much the exact argument. And it's truly one of the most bizarre things ever. Trying to explain how, well, when we attack these Muslim countries, it doesn't actually weaken Islam. It's actually the reason why Islam is taking over the West. It's actually the refugee crises that are created, or our war against Gaddafi was framed again as, you know, radical Islam or a radical Muslim leader is dangerous and has to be taken out. Of course, he gave up his nukes like an idiot, proving to everybody the entire time that the West cannot be trusted to provide security guarantees, because if you give up your nukes, then they have no reason to not attack you. So you give up your nukes on the agreement that you'll have a security guarantee, and then you give up your actual guarantee, and then they go to war with you, and you end up being murdered in the street with a bayonet. So that was a nice, big, clear signal to everybody else in the world that if you have nuclear weapons, you can survive, and if you don't, we will destroy you. And if we try to convince you to get rid of your nuclear weapons, you better not take that offer, because we'll betray you and murder you and then open up everything. So it seems to me as though the number one upshot outcome of the war in Iran so far has been to massively increase the reputation and, you know, reputation with its neighbors that Iran has. It seems like actually what's happening here is that the various sects of Islam, which are often at war with each other, are instead combining under a single banner economically and militarily for the first time in decades. So to me, that is an abject failure. It's actually the opposite of what everybody who wanted the war with Iran told us would happen. It's the inverse. So how'd that work out for you? So you went to war on the basis of they're Muslims, they chant death to America, we have to attack them on that basis. And then the outcome of that is that they're massively strengthened domestically. Their alliances with their neighbors that have never had any traction whatsoever are now being implemented. Yeah, I think this was a bad idea. I think this whole war in Iran thing has backfired in every possible way. If only somebody had warned us. Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, Kuwait, and Bahrain are now privately reaching out to Iran to discuss new security arrangements, sending multiple messages almost daily to Iran out of concern that the U.S. cannot protect them anymore due to interceptor shortages and the vulnerability of hosted U.S. bases, per Iran's parliament speaker Ghalibaf and senior Iranian source in Tehran familiar with the matter. Ghalibaf says, quote, "We've received numerous messages from neighboring countries about shaping new security arrangements and economic cooperation in the region. The United States put the security of every single one of its allies at such risk through bullying and pure disregard for their interests for the sake of Israel that they briefly saw their entire existence on the line." I almost have to laugh because it's like, what did you think was going to happen? Honestly, what did you think was going to happen? What did you think was going to happen when Iran started bombing all of the Gulf states and America's response was to pull all of the protection away from the Gulf states to hyper-focus on protecting Israel? What did they think was going to happen with South Korea when South Korea was asked to give up some of its defensive capabilities for the sake of Israel's voluntary war of aggression and, you know, land acquisition against Iran? What did you think was going to happen when all these things took place? Like, what, are you confused? Are you shocked by this? What did you think was going to happen when every time you have negotiations, Israel kills the negotiators? Did you not know that that's the only sure way to end the very possibility of negotiations forever? What did you think was going to happen? That's sort of the unofficial motto of the show these days is like, what did they think was going to happen? What did you know, in Switzerland, 80% of the North African immigrants have been accused of a crime. What did you think was going to happen? Honestly. The U.S. military has permanently lost access to 15 Persian Gulf bases, with Iran now poised to control access to the Gulf states. And the U.S. is having to negotiate new access in Western Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Southern Europe, per retired general, U.S. General Barry McCaffrey. This comes as the Trump administration is already weighing a smaller U.S. military presence in the Persian Gulf due to damaged bases, and the Pentagon saying it might not rebuild U.S. bases like they were before the Iran war. Which, again, is good. That's good. Hey, getting what we want, getting what we voted for, just in the worst possible way you could ever imagine. And so now Besant is unveiling sanctions designed to cripple Iran. Because it's not like we've been doing that for the last several decades. Oh, this one will really hurt them. Now they're really going to suffer. Really, it's just not so much going to work, I don't think. I remember Scott Bessent, I mean, this is why he was brought in as Treasury Secretary, to wage economic war against the enemies of Israel. He was a employee of George Soros doing this exact thing in the private sector before. That's how he got his bona fides. The plan that Bessent has, he's dubbed Operation Economic Outcast. It's aimed at ratcheting up pressure on the Iranian regime amid the current no war, no deal limbo. U.S. officials say the extended secondary sanctions are expected to be the main course of action against Iran until at least after the midterm elections, when a new military campaign could again be on the table. Oh, so there you go. Don't you love when they say stuff like this, when they're just like, we know that what we're doing is unpopular, so we're going to not do it until you all vote for us again, then we'll do it more. But, you know, for the next couple of weeks, you know, we need to pretend that we're not doing something so deeply unpopular with the American people. We're going to step back from the honesty for a minute so we can trick people into voting for us, so we can continue to do the thing that nobody wants us to do. That's nice when they let us know that, like, actually, this isn't, like, we are still going to be destroying ourselves over Israel's demand that we remain in the war with Iran. We will continue to spend American lives, blood, money, of course, reputation overseas. We will continue to do that. We know it's unpopular, so we're not doing it right now because the midterms are coming up. We need people to vote. We need rubes and idiots and fools to vote for us, so we need to trick them for a little bit. So glad we're all on the same page. Glad you just came out there and said it. Now, supposedly, this news of what essentially could very easily become a Middle Eastern NATO, a Middle Eastern, you know, power bloc headed by Iran, is a total surprise to Trump and Netanyahu. Reports claim Iran may join the new Mecca Defense Pact, linking Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and nuclear-armed Pakistan. Remember, Saudi Arabia, Wahhabia, Sunni Muslim, Iran, Shiite Muslim, Turkey, Shiite, right? Are they Sunni? Well, it doesn't really matter. You know, normally these people are at each other's throats, but because of the actions of Donald Trump at the behest of Israel, they are all getting over their, you know, intramural differences, and they're all aligning together now. So is that what you want? Was that the goal? Is this what was the design? Everybody who told me that we had to do this to defeat Islam, defeat Muslims, was it your plan to have Muslims create a gigantic, powerful military bloc? That wasn't your design, was it? I mean, was that on purpose? That's crazy. What the West dismissed as Sunni NATO is rapidly becoming something far more dangerous, the first real pillar of a post-American security architecture in the Middle East, quietly backed by Russia and China. Pakistan's powerful army chief, Asim Munir, is in Tehran right now to negotiate Iran's entry as the fourth member. At the same time, Trump personally called him last week, begging Pakistan to drag Iran back to the negotiating table. This is not a sectarian alliance. This is the beginning of a regional order designed to push the United States out as the indispensable power. While Washington threatens the toughest sanctions in history and the global fuel crisis deepens, Tehran is walking through the front door of a new defense pact. It was never supposed to include it. The old American strategy of keeping Sunni and Shia divided is collapsing in real time. So well done, idiots. Well done, morons. 6 month the warnings about Iran that came before the war is now reaching its 6 month mark. Days before going to war with Iran in February, President Trump summoned his intelligence chief to the Oval Office to ask whether a full-on assault was a good idea. Iran was at its weakest point in decades, senior aides and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu told him, providing Trump with a rare opportunity to dismantle Iran's nuclear program and bolster his legacy as a peacemaker. Yeah, and defeat the Muslims, remember? Trump, you just got to do this. We'll get rid of the nuclear threat. We'll destroy Islam. We'll give them a big, you know, black mark across their face. You'll be a hero and a genius celebrated throughout the world, and it'll probably make you more popular, and you'll sweep the midterms if you do this. And it's like, have you noticed, Trump? I don't know if you've noticed this. Have you noticed everything they say is the opposite of the truth? Have you noticed that? Have you noticed that everything they said would happen as a result of this war hasn't only not happened, the opposite has occurred? Have you noticed that yet? Because it keeps happening every time. Isn't that crazy? According to people familiar, so the question was whether a large-scale attack would work and possibly topple the regime. Then-Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard outlined assessments from America's intelligence apparatus. According to people familiar with the meeting, she told Trump that killing Iran's supreme leader would likely usher in a more hardline regime, open to acquiring nuclear weapons. Tehran would rush to close the Strait of Hormuz, destabilizing the global energy market, and it would strike U.S. forces and partners in the Middle East, prompting questions about American resolve and reliability with allies. So they did know. So they were aware of what they were doing. I mean, it would be very convenient for this meeting to have never happened and for them to be able to pretend like the outlook was good and that this was a smart move that somehow went wrong. But when you have the head of your domestic intelligence telling you in black and white exactly what would occur if you were to do this and then you do it anyway, then I have to believe it's on purpose. I have to believe you understood that this was the case and you did it on purpose, or you were lied to by the Israelis and you believed them. Either one is bad. You weren't given this intelligence that this would be a super quick, you know, 4-day operation. That didn't come from the American intelligence. The Pentagon denied that and told everybody what a risk it would be. Tulsi Gabbard knew what a risk it would be. All of the American representatives knew how terrible this would be. Here's the problem. The American government, the executive branch, our military, and most importantly, our media is occupied by Israel-first Jewish people that conspire to keep Trump in a sort of Truman World-esque fake reality that makes him make bad decisions. So we got to solve that problem somehow before we can be sovereign and make sense of any of this and actually have Americans making decisions based on American interest. It's like, let's just be perfectly clear. Like, the Pentagon was against this. The Congress was against this. Tulsi Gabbard was against this. Israel was for it. Okay? Without Israel influence, every American leader with American interests in mind knew this was bad. And if Israel wasn't there to influence things, we would have never done this. So when you think about the unending and, I mean, to this point, seemingly perpetual failure of the Iran war, seems to only get worse, more desperate, more humiliating, more chaotic as time goes on, all of it can be laid at the feet of Benjamin Netanyahu, but more importantly, his collaborators in the American government, people like Mike Waltz, people like Mike Waltz, who was the one who leaked the signal chat to his fellow Zionist at the Atlantic, the one who was caught collaborating and negotiating and communicating with Benjamin Netanyahu in secret before Netanyahu came to pitch the Iran war to Trump. Like a traitor, somebody who committed treason, who was collaborating with a foreign state in order to get America into war. Now, he wasn't even punished. He was made ambassador to the UN. That was his slap on the wrist for getting caught committing literal treason. But he, of course, isn't the only one. And it seems like at this point, everybody making decisions on behalf of America is in fact just a straight up Israeli agent. And I'm not even really exaggerating, right? Who is negotiating for us in Iran? It's Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, two diehard Jewish Zionists who clearly and routinely show their loyalty to the foreign state of Israel. So are they even arguing on behalf of us? It's really hard to tell. And of course, the Iranians themselves and others have routinely warned the Trump administration that Kushner and Witkoff were using the negotiations to make money and, you know, weren't being serious about it. But that's just one. Meanwhile, you've got CIA Director Ratcliffe covertly flying to Moscow for high-level meetings. And of course, if you're familiar at all with Ratcliffe, you know, he also is deeply tied into this Zionist mafia that currently runs things. And then, of course, you've got Larry Ellison taking over all these various media properties. And it's frankly extremely obnoxious and infuriating that it really does seem like, well, of course, Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, he, of course, was vetted by Larry Ellison himself in an email, I believe, to, at the time, it was Israel's spy master, but basically saying, yeah, Rubio's one of our guys. He'll be very good for us. And this was before anybody knew who Rubio was, but he had to be vetted before he was allowed to even become a congressman, let alone Secretary of State. So it's not all that complicated. Our government, the American government, is literally occupied by Zionist mafia. It's pretty simple. And it's a long-term plan. Like, here's one little thing that you should probably know, or like just think about for a little bit. So Benjamin Netanyahu's family was there in, you know, mandatory Palestine and were like diehard Zionists who believed from before the time Netanyahu was born, Benjamin Netanyahu was born, like their family would have a key role to play in the building of Israel. So we've got this family, the Milikowskis, they changed their name. You know, one of their sons dies a hero's death rescuing Jewish hostages who were kidnapped and on a plane hijacking. And he becomes a hero in Israel. And the Netanyahu family, like his family, from the beginning dedicated, like his father, one of the early Zionists, and like they were dedicated to Zion. They were dedicated to Israel. Their whole family identity was tied up in that they would be a central pillar of the Israeli state. Now, why am I hammering this so much? Because when Netanyahu was a very young boy, the family moved to America. Think about that. Really think about that. If your family's entire thing is being Zionist, why do you leave Israel and go to America? Because it's a long-term plan. Because they understand that America would be needed as a buffer, as a patron, as a protector of the state of Israel. So they needed people who could appeal to Americans. So they needed diehard Zionists to be raised in America so they could speak with an American accent and appeal to the American people and understand the American political structure and media structure so that they could serve Israel's interests as Americans, not as seen as foreign. You know, if you go back and watch old interviews from like Israeli leaders, they all had heavy Israeli accents until Netanyahu. So I really want you to like think about that. If your family is in Israel and their entire thing is wanting to be core members of the Israeli project, yet you go to America, it's because you were sent to America to establish bona fides so that you could later be used to bring America closer to Israel, which is why you have Benjamin Netanyahu as this media figure. He gets his start here in America as an American, you know, arguing on, you know, local TV shows, arguing about the state of the Middle East and whatever. And he got his sort of training and his bona fides through media appearances here in America, proving that he was American enough to appeal to the American people in a way that no person with an Israeli accent and a distinctly foreign sounding name could ever do. So just understand, like when I'm talking about the Zionist mafia, this is like a multi-generational thing. Benjamin Netanyahu was chosen for this role that he's currently playing and was prepared for it his whole life, and his family was sent to America on purpose, essentially as spies for Israel, but over decades. Like, really understand what we're dealing with here. That's just the beginning. More on the other side.
Generators have been destroyed. Bring in the water filters.
Releasing the water filters.
This is a good start, but we're going to need 1,000 more of these bad boys.
Thank you, Alex. Let the oceans be cleansed of this monstrous chemical.
They wanted to download my brain, but I downloaded theirs. It reversed all their demonic globalist plan. Team Humanity! All right, folks, let's go to our first caller. Big Hoss in Fort Worth, Texas. You're on the air, partner. Hit me.
Woohoo, Alex! Never thought I'd be on the horn with you, but I just had to call in about this methylene blue. Hell, this here blue juice done got this old cowboy feeling like a spring colt again. Keep pouring it out, partner.
Now that's what I want to hear. We're doing the best show and giving you the best products, and you can get them all at thealexjonesstore.com.
Woo-wee!
The age of men is over. Your walls will fall. Your people will scream. And your freedom will choke on our blades.
I will never kneel. I will never fall. I fight for the free people of this world, for truth, for blood, and for the last light of humanity. Rise with me.
Oh.
right, welcome back, folks.
Without a love to call my own, my life was incomplete. It seems I couldn't help but think that love was not for me. But my life took on a different twist when I met me a man that I couldn't resist. I didn't know what all I missed, and I'm getting happy. Oh, I'm getting happy.
All right, welcome back, folks. Second hour of War Room Live is on. I'll be opening up the phone lines in the third hour for your calls. But again, I want to try to express how, like, a lot of stuff going on right now in American culture, not just politics, is all downstream from this essentially Zionist mafia. You know, here's the exchange I was talking about earlier. Here's Larry Ellison vetting Marco Rubio on behalf of the Israeli ambassador in 2015. So it's the Israeli ambassador, Ron Proser. So Larry Ellison sends an email saying, "Hi, Ron, great meeting with Marco Rubio. I set him up to meet with Tony Blair. Marco will be a great friend to Israel." So, you know, it's just like, okay, so Larry Ellison, head of Oracle, one of the richest men in the world, American, right? The Oracle, the company, was sort of founded by the CIA, and he's made billions of dollars off of government contracts, and yet he is clearly concerned about Israel more than America. And he is, you know, vetting certain politicians for their loyalty to Israel in communications with official, you know, members of the government of Israel. Of course, Sam Altman, head of OpenAI. I mean, they have Zionist Jews at the top of all of the AI companies, all of the social media companies as well, with the exception of Elon Musk, who has been, violently cowed into comporting himself with the demands of the ADL. So he doesn't count. And then you've got things like this from the Gray Zone. The Gray Zone obtained leaked audio from AIPAC's 2025 congressional summit, in which the organizer's executive director, Elliot Brandt, boasts that his group had groomed several top Trump national security officials and is able to access their conversations to ensure they remain loyal. We can play the beginning of this. The whole video is about 7 minutes long, but let's go ahead and begin with clip one here from the Gray Zone. This is Elliot Brandt, the CEO of AIPAC. Let's watch.
We may not lobby the executive, but as we were talking about, there was a discussion earlier about Congress being representatives of the people. Well, the White House has to be responsive to Congress. And so it's working with, at the time, our friends on the Democratic side of the aisle to apply pressure the way that they know how to an administration, as it will be with this administration. Well, I was talking about the people who will get appointed into some of these jobs. Look, at the top level, we can talk about Marco Rubio and Michael Waltz. Those three people have something in common. They all serve in Congress. They all have relationships with key AIPAC leaders in their communities. So the lines of communication are good. Should there be something questionable or curious that we need access on the conversation to? You never got one of the first candidates I ever met with as an AIPAC professional in my job as a candidate for Congress was a guy named John Ratcliffe. He was challenging a long-time incumbent member of Congress. Dallas, this guy looks like he could win the race. When you go talk to him, he has a good understanding of the issues. And a couple of weeks ago, he took the oath as the CIA director, for crying out loud. This is a guy that they had a chance to speak to. So there are lifelines.
All right, so we can stop it there, and then we can play more of this later. But I think you got a pretty good rundown right there of how AIPAC operates and how long before Marco Rubio is Secretary of State, long before Mike Waltz is in a position to be communicating with Netanyahu secretly behind the back of Donald Trump as a key member of the White House administration, long before Elise Stefanik was appointed to her role as UN ambassador, they had all been co-opted by AIPAC, who maintains relations with them and works with Democrats in order to apply pressure where necessary to get the people they want in the positions they want, so they have direct lines to those people, including people like John Ratcliffe, the one representing America, going to Russia to negotiate. So I think we're occupied. I think we're fully occupied at this point. And so are a lot of...
Ladies and gentlemen, Bigley has launched an online pharmacy, 1776rx.health. It's one product we're launching with, My Decision. and that is ivermectin with benzidol, both powerful, really good anti-parasitics. It doesn't just get the big worms and all the crap that's out there. It's amoebas, it's microplasms. It is so important. These two together, I mean, ivermectin is a Nobel Prize winning for this, but benzidol is the big one. And folks, it isn't just parasites. Just search benzidol studies. Just put that into a search engine and you'll see congressional hearings. You'll see top scientists. You'll see all the studies on what else it does that they don't want you to know about. It's dramatic. So, and you won't know if you had any type of parasitical deal or whatever until you've done this. And a lot of people went there yesterday. A lot of people got it. Very smart move. 1776rx.health.
Stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets, the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. Barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is War Room Live. I'm your host, Harrison Smith. Yeah, like I said, I mean, this stuff is just kind of becoming too much, too overwhelming not to notice, right? And you got to think about the way this sort of network operates. You've got, if I can find it here, you've got Larry Ellison of Oracle in 2015 vetting Marco Rubio on behalf of the Israeli ambassador, letting him know that Marco Rubio would be a friend to their mafia. Now, he also says he set him up to meet Tony Blair. So you've got Tony Blair in this mix. Now, meanwhile, Larry Ellison's son is taking over basically every media property in America. Tony Blair's son is in charge of instituting digital ID in the UK. Marco Rubio, of course, now Secretary of State. He's a congressman back then, but as AIPAC explained, congressmen who want to get elected require help from AIPAC to get it, and you can see that with things like Thomas Massie. If they don't want you there, they have ways of getting rid of you. And so before these people ever become congressmen, they go and genuflect before AIPAC. They get the blessing of the mafia, and then they maintain that relationship throughout the congressional process, throughout their congressional time in office. And as Thomas Massie said, everybody has an AIPAC handler that directs them and tells them what to do. And of course, we know that's true of the Republicans. Thomas Massie said it was everybody but him that had this close relationship with their AIPAC handler. But also in that recording we just heard from the CEO of AIPAC, you know, he mentions that it's the Democrats too that they can lean on in order to pressure the Trump administration. So, you know, they can like pressure the Republicans to do what they want. And if the Republicans refuse, then they go to the Democrats. They say, hey, we're going to support you doing this as a negotiation tactic. Now we have leverage that we can wield to force the Republicans to do what we want because we'll empower the Democrats if they don't. And they're just openly talking. Well, not openly talking about this because it was a secretly recorded. But, you know, within their own confines, this is spoken about and acknowledged. It's not a conspiracy. It's not anti-Semitic. It's just their business operations. It's just how it works. And, of course, it talks about Ratcliffe, and the current CEO of AIPAC, apparently was a AIPAC. He calls himself an AIPAC professional. And you gotta wonder, like, what that means. Like, I guess that just means all day, every day, you're just advocating for Israel, lobbying for Israel, helping to coordinate media and, you know, congressional candidates, fundraising for them, all day, every day. And there's a lot of people like this. And it's one of those things where I guess the NGO label in America is very easily sort of manipulated. And you essentially have a bunch of people whose full-time jobs is like ethnocentrism for the Jewish people. Like literally, like get jobs right out of college with some Jewish organization. They spend couple years, like writing essays or articles promoting Israel's interests. Then they become lobbyists and they spend their time promoting Israel's interests. And it's like entire career paths available to certain sections of the population. But at the head of it are the princelings. I think that's a good way of thinking. They're princelings, right? Jared Kushner and Josh Kushner, are they real estate geniuses to be holding portfolios worth billions of dollars in their 30s? No, they were given it because of who they are, because of their family. Now, again, I'm not actually against the idea of like passing things on to your children. I think it's worth recognizing, however, that these people are placed at the top of like our most important governmental or private industries. And it's sort of blatant, right? I mean, how many could you name? I could name like Alexander Soros inherited his father's operation. So all of the Democrat politicians go and genuflect and show their obeisance to the newly crowned prince now that the king has retired. And you've got Jared Kushner, Josh Kushner. Didn't Josh Kushner's like buy the Lakers or something? Jared Kushner, of course, representing America in negotiations in the Middle East. Princelings. They're princelings of the shadow aristocracy. They inherit their position of authority and wealth, and they use it to progress the agenda of their class. And it's a mafia, but it operates almost like an aristocracy. David Ellison's son owning all of these media outlets. It's a little bit suspicious, isn't it? It's a little bit on the nose, as it were. And of course, people are noticing this and not very happy about it. And I talked about this a little bit yesterday, but it may be, I don't have any official stats, I think it might be the most liked tweet of all time. And it was made by somebody that I generally despise, right? Mark Ruffalo, not a good person, a very dumb and outspoken person, which is a bad combination. And again, you know, it's the endless frustration with people who, and I genuinely can't comprehend this whatsoever. It's like people that are wrong about everything will be right about Israel. People that are right about everything will be objectively wrong about Israel to the degree that is like shocking and incomprehensible. And that's the case here. It's the case with a lot of socialists on the left, because you got to understand, like, they perceive, I mean, said a million times, they're right about Israel for the same reason they're wrong about everything else, because they perceive the world this very simplistic brown versus white dichotomy. White people are the colonizers and they're bad. Brown people are the victims of colonization and they're good, ontologically, always, no matter what. Now, when you apply that metric, that rubric to the Israeli situation, yeah, it actually fits and you land on the correct side of things from a nationalistic or humanitarian point of view or Christian point of view. So there happens to be some overlap there. But the problem is that, like, for some reason, and again, I genuinely, it just blows my mind that, like, they can see what's happening in Israel with the settlements and the terror and the murder and the genocide. And like, they see all of that happening. And for some reason, they like think that that's also happening in America. Like, I don't understand, like, if you're really against this stuff, if you're really like, you really hate and genuinely are upset at what Israel is doing to all of its neighbors and even the people in its own borders, do you ever like look at that and go, wow, it's so bad there. I guess America's not so bad. I guess like we aren't doing anything even remotely close to anything like this. I guess all the outrage and fury I had for like white people kind of misplaced a little bit, because white people aren't doing this type of stuff to anybody anywhere and haven't for 100 years. So I just don't understand how you can be so clear-eyed about Israel and see what they're doing and see no difference between what Israel's doing and like the American system, just endlessly bending over backwards to serve its enemies. Like, it's crazy. It's crazy these people genuinely think that America is as bad as Israel, except that America is tied in with Israel and helping them do everything they do, obviously. And is that white people's fault? Is that white Christians' fault, I wonder? Why can they not be consistent? So Mark Ruffalo links Paramount Warner Bros. Merge to Oracle's technology work for Israel. This is from jpost.com. In an Instagram post, Ruffalo shared a video of Safra Katz, vice chair of Oracle, discussing the technological assistance the company provided to Israel following the Hamas-led October 7th attack. We played that video last week when it came out. And yeah, she's like, I can't talk about some of it, but Oracle's been doing some really amazing things helping Israel. Like, you going to do that here? Do you have any qualms about doing that? You seem very giddy and excited about the prospect of your technology being used to carry out a genocide. Where does that stop? Is that only for certain people, or do you just feel that about everybody? Because right now, the people that are being murdered in the West Bank are Christians. They're not Muslims. They're not radicals. They're not Hamas. But they're being slaughtered, and Oracle and Palantir and the Israeli government are helping them do it. So do we care? Do we care about that at all? I wonder. U.S. media giant Paramount slammed Hollywood actor Mark Ruffalo for invoking anti-Semitic tropes in an Instagram post on Friday in which he accused Israel of genocide and apartheid. The outspoken anti-Israel actor, known for his roles in the Avenger films, accused Paramount moguls David and Larry Ellison of powering some of the most destructive and inhuman forces in the world and warned of the danger of David Ellison's bid to combine Paramount with Warner Bros. Discovery. A spokesperson for Paramount said the company is troubled when anti-Semitic tropes are invoked in purported service of a business dispute. Words like genocide and apartheid applied to a corporate transaction aren't just wrong, they're a bridge too far, and they cheapen the very real suffering those words are meant to describe. Yes. What? Wait, what? No, the real suffering is happening right now in Palestine. What are you talking about? So everything gets a little confusing when you try to peer through this particular looking glass. Ruffalo encourages followers to look how she revels in what we have now come to see as a genocide, which was built on apartheid system of oppression powered by Oracle. And it was, and it is, and they, you know, are very proud of that. Just like, I probably should have brought in the videos, but I mean, go watch the Eighth Front War. I mean, all the videos are in there in the Eighth Front War. You've got, actually, I don't know if I put it in, but Larry Ellison's exactly the same where, you know, he's on video and they're like, so do you give a lot to the IDF, right? And he's like, 100%. Everything I have is done for Israel, and I support the military there. I support the IDF. I'm their biggest funder. Oracle works with their military, provides our technological services. Like, it's not a question. It's not like he's moderate. It's not like, well, you know, we got to do it. He loves it. He's for it. He's in favor of it. He celebrates it. You're just not allowed to notice. You're just not allowed to talk about it. He can celebrate it, right? Larry Ellison, David Ellison, they can brag about how much they give to Israel. They can brag about how their Judaism is central to their identity and inspires their support of Israel. But if you dare to suggest yourself that you dislike the fact that these American billionaires in charge of some of the biggest, most important technological companies in America are in fact deeply traitorous and more loyal to a foreign power, I think you just got to deal with that. You got to accept that. You got to understand that we're allowed to say things and notice things and be against things. That's just being a human. Paramount hits back at lefty actor Mark Ruffalo over unhinged anti-Semitic rant against Warner Bros. Merger. Paramount clapped back. Don't you love when corporations are sassy TikTok chicks? Paramount clapped back at Hollywood actor Mark Ruffalo and accused him of invoking anti-Semitic tropes in an unhinged rant where he raged against the company's proposed Warner Brothers merger. So here's the actual tweet. And last time I checked, yesterday it had 850,000 likes. I've never seen anything like that. I have never seen a post with 850,000 likes. 100,000 likes is almost unheard of. So clearly what Mark Ruffalo was saying is fairly popular. So let's take a look. The accusation that I'm anti-Semitic is appalling and fundamentally dishonest. Criticizing the actions of the Israeli prime minister, a military contract, or the executives who supply it is not the same as criticizing Jewish people. Not according to the IHRA. Actually, according to the definition of anti-Semitism adopted by our federal government and increasingly by state and local governments, like San Diego in California, which just passed a resolution adopting the IHRA and saying that it's anti-Semitic and therefore hate speech to criticize Benjamin Netanyahu. So, I mean, is it or not? Is criticizing, you know, Jewish people doing things, is that criticizing all Jews? If it is, then, you know, what does that say about how we handle the problem of, you know, foreign subversion in our government? If that's not what it means, then why is everybody saying it is? Why is everybody saying it's anti-Semitic if you're just criticizing this country? But Mark Ruffalo goes a little off the rails here. He says the critical and necessary dialogue is when is then dishonestly framed as being anti-Israel. To be clear, my views come from my own political convictions and should never be interpreted as hostility towards Jewish people for whom I have deep love and respect. Okay, but are you pro-Israel? Like, he's like, that part I don't understand. The critical and necessary dialogue is then dishonestly framed as being anti-Israel. It's okay to be anti-Israel. Why is everybody so scared all the time? It's okay, you can be anti-Israel. That's fine. Why would you not be anti-Israel? It's like, what? He's like against Israel's president and against what they're doing and against their influence in America and against the genocide they're carrying out. But he wants you to know he's not anti-Israel, which makes this whole thing incomprehensible and retarded, but it's fine. To be clear, my views come from my own political convictions and should never be interpreted as hostility towards Jewish people for whom I have a deep love and respect. Everything I know about acting, activism, and humanism has been profoundly shaped by the Jewish friends, colleagues, and loved ones who have been integral and family throughout every point in my life. The merger has real consequences for real people, for the entire country. Scrutinizing the Ellisons, including Oracle's business built on data, surveillance technology, and government contracts, and the serious threat of editorial freedom and the loss of a livelihood for thousands of families is fair and necessary. The $111 billion deal would hand one family control over CNN, HBO, and Warner Brothers, backed in part by foreign money whose influence on editorial decisions has never been fully explained to the public. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have called for serious national security review, and regulators still haven't given the public a real answer. Until they do, the merger should not move forward. Now is the time to dive boldly into all these issues, not step back or concede. Well, you did kind of step back and concede at the beginning of this, but that's fine. You're scared. You're a scared little boy. That's okay. You don't really understand what's actually going on here, and you're scared to actually name the problem for what it is. That's fine. People like me are here to do what you are too stupid or cowardly to do yourself. See, what are you talking about, Mark Ruffalo? I really want to know, what is your issue? Because if it's not the fact that they're Jewish, it's the fact that they're Israeli-aligned, but you're not anti-Israel, and actually everything you believe was formulated first and foremost by a Jewish mindset, I just don't really understand. I just don't really get where why he's upset. Because, see, I am approaching this from, my opinion, a fairly principled stance, which is I don't trust the government. I don't trust the intelligence community. I think a Jewish Zionist mafia has taken control of not only huge sectors of our federal government, but obviously is systematically consolidating their control over every media outlet, including TikTok, including every TV station and news station, including AI. And I'm against that from a nationalistic point of view, as well as a moral and religious point of view. What does he have against David and Larry Ellison? Like, is Mark Ruffalo against all the stuff that they're for? Because I think he's probably deeply in favor of most of the stuff that they're for. This is where it gets, like, really nonsensical. It's the same thing with, like, Larry Fink and BlackRock. Like, if you talk to a leftist, they say they hate BlackRock. But BlackRock is the engine that created and drove their entire movement. So how can they hate BlackRock? You hate BlackRock, and yet BlackRock is the one that created ESG scores, that created the financial system that forces companies to accept DEI, that deliberately kept out white Christian men from your industry, which is why your industry is now failing, and they're the ones stopping your industry from actually failing by pumping it full of fraudulent money so that you can keep making movies that nobody wants to watch and keep making streaming shows that nobody subscribes for, and for some reason the money just keeps rolling in. It's because BlackRock and Larry Fink is literally your daddy, that he is your godfather, he is your mind, he is your puppet master manipulating you every step of the way. He is the source of your every belief, and yet you think you hate him. And yet you think you oppose him. You think you oppose David and Larry Ellison because of Israel, but do you oppose the spying on the American people? And if so, under what moral framework are you operating? Because you were in favor of, like, destroying people's lives for not taking a COVID mask, for not wearing a COVID mask or taking the COVID vaccine. You know, but star in movies whose entire point is to, in a propagandistic way, systematically dismantle the, you know, classic American worldview and mindset. So what, so like, where are you coming? What are you actually doing? Who do you actually support? Who do you oppose? Because it gets a little bit confusing to me. It gets a little bit confusing when all of the Soros funded retarded leftist activists truly, sincerely believe that they're opposing the powerful forces that are funding and directing them. It's really baffling. Doesn't make any sense. So, I don't know about you. I didn't see anything anti-Semitic in here. I didn't see anything. I mean, I saw quite the opposite, actually. I saw a profusion of love for Israel and the Jewish people. Just, you know, I want to be concerned, but I want to make sure that we understand what's going on here. But it's like, this causes the outrage. This has all these media outlets talking about the vile anti-Semitism of Mark Ruffalo when he's literally just like, yeah, the Ellisons love genocide and I don't want them to be in charge of the entire media landscape in America. Yeah, you probably shouldn't. It's because they're like bad people. And it's because they are. Yeah, Mark Ruffalo telling people to self-isolate during the coronavirus outbreak. So, I mean, yeah, the Imagine video. But this is what I mean. It's like, so where are you coming from? You don't believe in, like, freedom, right? It's like Arnold Schwarzenegger, screw your freedom. So this is what I really don't understand. It's like, how do you people choose when to believe things? I think that is really the crux of the issue. How do you choose? Because I'm baffled by it. I can't tell you one way or the other. It's like, when it comes to like Fourth Amendment violations, I'm against all of them no matter what. It's pretty easy. You could actually, you know, pretty much predict what I'm going to feel about something on the basis of whether it violates some of our God-given rights dictated or enumerated in the Bill of Rights. So it's pretty simple to know where I'm coming from. For these guys, how do you know? How do they know what they're supposed to like and what they're supposed to dislike? How do they know? They know they're against colonialism, but they love 10 million Indians coming in and occupying whole sections of America or, you know, European countries. So they're not actually against colonialism. You know, are they against Israel? Are they against the Israelis here in America? Then why do they believe all of the same things to them up to and only excluding the actions of the state of Israel during war? Because they believe everything else about it. I just don't know where they're getting their signal from. Where is the NPC broadcasting home base? Because I'd like to know how they are able to determine what they believe and when. They certainly don't have any qualms about violating your privacy. They don't have any qualms about throwing you in a camp if you don't take their experimental shot. They're all for that. They want to ruin your life for merely disagreeing with them. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought these people had brains. I'm sorry. For a second, I was trying to actually find a logical through line. I forgot. They're all empty vessels. They're all sacks of crap. Sorry. My bad. I thought they had brains for a little.
Benjamin, how do you always have the coolest clothes in town?
The AlexJonesStore.com, of course, my dear.
Really? That's so cool.
Of course.
TheAlexJonesStore.com!
Stranded on a deserted island with no food, no supplies, and no hope? Don't worry. The castaways had one thing the others didn't. Supplements from TheAlexJonesStore.com. While everyone else was eating coconuts, they were powering through the apocalypse. TheAlexJonesStore.com. Because survival starts with being prepared.
We have to fight for our sovereignty. We have to fight to protect, again, what God gave us, which, I mean, our health is one of the biggest things. We're all at this point middle-aged. We're trying to have families. And I think with the transhumanist agenda, there is a little bit of a psyop afoot.
Where, oh, I've said that. But the other day when I had you guys coming on, I said, we're doing something about what we can take control of. Mm. And then the last few years, Joe Rogan, one time at dinner, goes, about 3 years ago, you're fat. Your own enemy. He does that to guests. He's like Theo Von, too. Get off that Prozac, you idiot. And people were mad at him. That's tough love Joe does. And he's there with Sean Johnson, the Navy SEAL guy that I'd known for years, wasn't really friends. Sean goes, fine, I'll train you. I'll meet you every morning. And I said, all right, let's do it. And then I lost like 70 pounds, and I kind of halfway cut back and gained back 10. But now I'm back to where I was. I'm going to go even lower. But the whole point is that Joe goes, you know, you're your own worst enemy. You think the globalists are going to kill you. You're killing yourself. And so that's where Masterpiece comes in. That's where doing all this comes in. I mean, this is real, folks. Methylene Blue works. Bovine colostrum works. This, getmasterpiece.com. The Masterpiece is unbelievable.
We are at a crossroads with the survival of the human species. And the people that have all the resources and all have spelled that out very clearly to us. And the things that they are putting inside of our body to complete that mission. You got to get out. The fact of the matter is, zeolite, which is one of the main ingredients of Masterpiece, has been proven in all ways to remove every toxin that it's looked at grabbing. It performs. That's why it's called the Master Binder.
But yours is different.
It's completely different.
Because it doesn't just pull stuff. It brings in the key C minerals.
Yes, absolutely. So any way that you would actually test Masterpiece out, which would be like its pH, its molecular composition, its molecular ratio, if it's isotonic and whatnot, it is identical to blood plasma. Talking about marine plasma, sea plasma, minerals, it is the same molecular composition of as your blood profile. And so why does that matter? Blood is life. When you are grabbing the problem with our bodies, with the toxins in there, which is disrupting how our bodies perform on every level, it's literally made our bodies mineral deficient. Toxins take the place of minerals. So when the Masterpiece is carrying in minerals, when it takes a toxin, it's giving the perfect minerals right there at that time. That's why everyone that looks at the testing, whether it's our hair tissue mineral analysis practitioners, our blood testers, which we've done three different independent third-party labs doing different blood testing, they've never seen results like
that. Yeah, so regular zeolite just pulls out bad stuff. It doesn't replace it. This is zeolite with a good thing, pulls out bad, it goes bloop, good.
Yeah. Our bodies are magical if you get the poisons out.
Reality starts here. AlexJonesLive.com. Share the link. Spread the word.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
Very good. Jolene. See, I was thinking about it during the break. Please don't take him just because and you this, can. It really is an underlying thing that is so consistent and so constant that, like, right wingers have souls. They really do. And they change their mind when what they thought turns out not to be true. And something else is true, they actually change their minds because they're actually principled. I can think of so many people that I personally know that, like, after October 7th, 2023, they were, like, very much on Israel's side. And I'd kind of argue with them a little bit, but, you know, they truly believe that Israel is a good guy. And yet all of those people that I can think of, they have all come around because when they actually look into it, when they actually study this stuff, they realize, like, wow, Israel really are the aggressors here. They really are the ones violating, you know, the national sovereignty of the Palestinians, the national sovereignty of Lebanon, like from a nationalistic perspective, from a humanitarian perspective, from simply a human perspective about, you know, the usefulness or righteousness or not of vengeance and the terror that Israel wields. Like, so many people who I used to argue with accepted it and went, okay, you know what? It turns out Israel's not great. Actually, when I actually looked into it, I realized that I can't support Israel and be consistent with the rest of my beliefs. And so many people I know have come around like that. I've never seen anything like that from the left. I've never seen anything like that from the left where they look at an issue and go, you know, if I'm going to be consistent in my beliefs, I can't go along with this anymore. I can't go along. You know, how many people, like, because in one way you can kind of understand when they're so deluded, their positions make sense. If you genuinely believe, because you've been told or it's been insinuated to you or you have just absorbed from the media deception that worms its way into your subconscious, if you actually believe that, like, white cops are killing 10,000 black men a year unarmed and getting away with it, yeah, you'd be pretty outraged. I understand that. I don't even begrudge them that. If you're lied to like that, you should get mad. But then if you actually look into it, and you probably should, and you realize it's not true, then why do you keep promoting it? And then why do you then actually try to silence and censor and block out the people telling you the facts about what's going on because it conflicts with your warped and misaligned initial worldview? I mean, it really makes no sense. And it is a constant that I see that people on the right will change their mind. People on the right that thought all this stuff, whether it's about Israel or whether it's about, like, white people, you know, used to be people, wow, that's a distraction. They're dividing us by race. They want us. Now they're going, well, the great replacement is real. And I wouldn't be in favor of this if it was happening to anybody else. So why would I be in favor of this when it's happening to white people? Like, people actually look into issues and realize that their stance is incompatible with their actual beliefs. And so they change their stance. The left just never, ever, ever does that. And it would be great. It would be just absolutely wonderful if the left, they got a little taste of censorship or, you know, media manipulation from the Trump administration, and they're screaming and crying. I mean, my God, I mean, Donald Trump insults, whatever his name is, Jimmy. That doesn't help you. The late night host, Jimmy Kimmel. That's the one. I was thinking Jimmy Neutron. Maybe I should call him Jimmy Neutron. Jimmy K, like, insults Jimmy Kimmel, and it's like, oh my God, the First Amendment is being destroyed. It's like, have you ever stopped to think, like, wow, this is what we've been doing the whole time. Wow, is this how it feels? I guess those conservatives were right about the value of the First Amendment and the necessity of freedom of speech, because just because the people in power think you're wrong, that's no reason for them to be allowed to shut you down. Remember how we've been making that argument for the last, couple of centuries? And you people have criticized us and said, oh, you just want to spread hate speech. So when you have very sincere and well-grounded objections to a mafia cabal of Zionist psychopath murderers and supporters of genocide, and you're called anti-Semitic, does it hit anything in your brain? Is that ball bouncing around in the empty space? Does it collide with any memories, perhaps, where you go, huh, you know, if they're calling me anti-Semitic when I'm not, and I'm clearly just making a very valid argument against these particular people, not because they're Jews, but because they're bad people, maybe that's what's been going on with the right wing the whole time. Maybe they're not racist in the same way I'm not anti-Semitic. Maybe we can have objections to things, whether it's Jewish people or black people or Asian people or whatever else, and it's not actually inherently based on a hidden hatred of that group. Maybe these labels are just weapons used to silence valid discussion. No leftist has ever made that leap. It's a phenomenon, and truly it's shocking. And we should, like, it'd be worth studying at an academic level the brains of these people to figure out why that never happens, why it's never happened. The only time maybe it's happened is with the Young Turks, and they're still lefties. They're still anti-white. They still don't actually understand anything, but at least they were direct, because that is what happened with Anna Kasparian. She got attacked by a homeless person. She talked about being attacked by a homeless person on her show, and people called her racist. And she kind of woke up a little bit and went, well, wait a second. You're now silencing a victim because of the race of the perpetrator. That's wrong. Yeah, duh, it always was, which is what we were saying the entire time. What we continue to say and have been saying. So it's... This is why we're never going to, like, actually have any alliance with the left. It's just, it's never going to happen because their brains are not capable of it. They really aren't. I don't know what to tell you. It's never happened. Kasparian's like the best example I could get, but it's still not actually, she didn't actually go through with it. She's not actually overcame her leftism and is now like on the side of white Christians trying to defend their homeland against the dismantling that's going on by all of these various foreign forces. It just never happens. I don't know why. I really don't. But even when they themselves are subjected to what they've done to other people, it never like connects in their brain. So, what am I supposed to tell you? Like, I can get why they wouldn't like data centers because of the economic environmental implications. But do they actually have a sincere dislike of, like, mass data collection? Do they actually care about mass surveillance? They don't. They really don't. They will care if it's them that are being subjected to it, or if they're scared they'll be objected to it, then they'll be against it. They're not actually principled in any of this stuff. So it's hard to take them seriously. Even when they're right about stuff, it's like an accident. And it's like they have to like insist that they're wrong. They're like, I know I'm right about Israel, but I actually still love Israel and I refuse to acknowledge that any behavior of any American, you know, could be because they're more loyal to Israel. I'll never say that. I'll never actually complete the thought. Taking one step has been a terrifying adventure for me, and it's really hard not to take that step back, but I'm not going any farther, that's for damn sure. So again, it's a shame. It's a shame. It really is. Because you would think that being called anti-Semitic, it maybe be a little bit of a wake-up call. That like, these labels are not accurate, they're just to shut up people who are, by the way, right and accurate. You know, you don't have to call people names if they're wrong. You can just say they're wrong. In fact, calling somebody names when they're wrong sort of undercuts your argument about how they're wrong. If Mark Ruffalo was wrong about what he said, they would have criticized him for it. They didn't. They just called him anti-Semitic. Just like when we talk about crime statistics or whatever else, we get called racist, not because we're wrong, because they just don't want us saying the truth. Very simple. Wish we'd get some credit for being right about this stuff the entire time and actually being principled and consistent throughout all of this, not ever changing depending on who exactly is doing the bad thing, whether we think it's bad or not. No, it's all bad. This is all bad. And even when they're doing it ostensibly in our name, even when it's quote unquote Republicans doing it, it's still bad. This is the type of moral paradigm that is not to be found anywhere outside of these studios, apparently. Let's go to clip 7 here. This is billionaire Larry Ellison. This clip was in the Eighth Front War. We've played it many times, but this is the guy whose son now is trying to buy HBO and CNN and Warner, Discovery, Paramount. He wants to own all of the news outlets and all of the entertainment outlets and all of the movie production houses. Not because he's the best, not because he's particularly skilled. He didn't work his way up from the bottom. He's the son of Larry Ellison. He's a princeling. He is the inheritor of an aristocratic position, which we should all be against. So you'll see these clips in the Eighth Front War. Let's watch the whole thing now. Billionaire Larry Ellison wants data centralization and total surveillance, saying citizens will be on their best behavior because we're constantly watching and recording everything that's going on. Let's watch.
Your body cams will be transmitting that. The police will be on their best behavior. Because we're constantly recording, watching and recording everything that's going on. Citizens will be on their best behavior because we're constantly recording and reporting everything that's going on.
When you come to government and what government's doing, there are artificial intelligence tools, and some of them I know that Oracle have developed around financial management for government. But also, tell us a bit about because you're right at the forefront of this revolution, what it means for what government should do in terms of its digital infrastructure, digital ID, data centers, and so on.
How do you take advantage of these incredible AI models? And the first thing a country needs to do is to unify all of their data so it can be consumed and used by the AI model. You have to take all of your healthcare data, your diagnostic data, your electronic health records, your genomic data. And you know, in the Middle East, in the UAE, for example, they're incredibly rich in data. They have a lot of population data. The NHS in the UK has an incredible amount of population data. But it's fragmented. It's not easily accessible by these AI models. We have to take all of this data we have in our country and move it into a single, if you will, unified data platform. So we provide context. When we want to ask a question, we've provided that AI model with all the data they need to understand our country. So that's the big step. That's kind of the missing link. We need to unify all of the national data, put it into a database where it's easily consumable by the AI model, and then ask whatever question you like.
So you're really, through the use of this, you're revolutionizing the way government works, right? The services it provides, the way that it operates. What about things like financial management, procurement? How can AI help a government operate more efficiently, more effectively, you know, give a more direct and better service to the citizen?
Well, we have these modern financial systems. So, countries can, and all, for example, the AI system will help you do that. But again, the secret is to get all of that data in one place. Without having the basic data, it doesn't have the, it cannot answer the question about your country.
So, we can pull it down there, but I mean, that's basically everything you need to know, right? Citizens are going to be on their best behavior, you know, according to Larry Ellison. Now, what that means, we don't really know. Because the way things are going, there's really only one crime, and it's anti-Semitism. There's only one sin, and it's anti-Semitism, okay? You know, they're not putting up flock cameras to stop the gangsters flaunting their illegal guns all over the place. That's, you know, the murderer, he's going to get let out 30 or 40 times before he finally gets put away. But anti-Semitism, that will be identified and punished. So again, when he's talking about best behavior, he's not talking about in an objective moral sense. He's talking about in a personal sense. The police will be on their best behavior. Of course they will. But again, it's all about centralizing. It's got to be one database, which is why you have these data centers being built to manage all of the information that's coming from Flock and from your cell phone and from the financial records, obviously, because this is the mark of the beast. Do you think the liberals care? Like, again, my objection to this stuff is very, like, straightforward, right? I'm just like, people deserve privacy because that's it's how you think your own thoughts. It's what allows you to actually come to the truth. You need to be able to speak freely. You need to be able to speak without even the threat or possibility of some other outside force listening in and judging what you're saying. These things are necessary to be a human being, just like, in my opinion, being armed is necessary to be a human being and not a subject, not a slave. So my belief in all this stuff, fairly consistent. Oracle will build more cloud infrastructure data centers than all of its competitors combined, says Larry Ellison. And it's no coincidence that the name of the company is literally Oracle. Like, you know, when people talked to so-called gods back in the day in order to predict the future. That's what all of this is about. And again, it's not a coincidence. Let's go down to clip number 10. This is Eric Moutsos at Real Eric Moutsos on X, warning about the automatic financial controls and surveillance data that data centers are gathering and will be able to collate, creating a de facto social credit score. Only in this case, not even pretending to be run by, you know, a central government program that actually benefits its people. Like, again, I mean, we could have exactly the same technology as China. It would be worse here. It would be worse here. Because say what you want about the Chinese government, and we do, they do at least seem to in some way try to benefit their people. I mean, they're holding, you know, robotic Olympiads. And every day I see some new crazy AI chalkboard that they've invented, or a flying car, or, you know, an airport worth $20 billion that looks like it came out of a freaking Star Trek TV show. So, you know, it would be a little different. Like, if we had the Chinese surveillance network, it wouldn't just be that we would be as bad as China. We would be worse, because we're ruled by people that genuinely despise us and would use that power to hurt us in any way that they can. So here's Eric Moutsos talking about the threat that really is behind the AI data centers.
And this is yet another reason why they need data surveillance centers.
If you look at what they want to do, what they want to do is put on your currency, your bank deposits, and your stocks and bonds what I call a manual, an automatic third lock. Do you know what a third lock is?
No.
Okay, let me describe this. If you and I do a transaction, and I want to buy a Tucker Carlson hat, and you want to sell it to me, I give you cash, I get the hat. That's a two-lock transaction. You have a lock, I have a lock. If one of us says no, it can't happen, okay? Let's say we have money in the bank, and I want to buy the hat. I'm going to transfer money. I'll do an ACH to you for the cost of the hat. The bank has rules from the Treasury Department. It has sanctions. It has to know your customer rules. It has other regulations. And it has the ability to intercede and stop the transaction for those reasons, okay? And that's a sort of what I call a manual third lock. So the bank gets a third lock implementing the government regulations. And so if you look at what happened to the truckers in Canada, they had not all, but most of the banks exercised that manual third lock under the direction of the government. What the government wants to do, and what the Treasury and the central banks want, is they want an automatic third lock. So you don't have to go through the bank. And not only can you apply sanctions and know your customer and money laundering laws, you can apply a full-blown social credit system, right? So I can make up a hugely complex rule system for Tucker and his kids and his grandkids. I can customize it for each one of you, and I can give you incentives, and I can give you rules. And unless you do exactly what I say, I can turn off your money. Or I can apply negative interest rates to your money, or positive interest rates. I can raise your taxes without anybody having any say about it. So let me give you an example. Go back to the pandemic. If I say you're locked down and you and your family can't leave your house, your money won't work outside your house if I have an all-digital system with an automatic third lock. And let's say I freeze your bank account. You can't go to your bank and talk to them. It's above their head. They won't be implementing it. Okay. That gives them, that's what the data centers are for. That's what the AI is for, at least in North America. You know, the goal of that, because if you look at spatial control, it involves tremendous data because of the videos and the cameras, and you've got lots of video footage. But then you can imagine financial transactions.
So there you go, Catherine Austin Fitz explaining the third lock to Tucker Carlson, and that third lock will be controlled by the likes of Larry Ellison, Oracle, these private companies. And you'll have no recourse, and they're already establishing the laws, which means that it's, you know, it's not going to be, and you see this already, a murderer can get a bank account. A mass murderer, a rapist, a convicted mass rapist could get a bank account in this country. You know who can't get bank accounts? People who question Israel online, because they're anti-Semitic, and we can't have our bank contributing to anti-Semitism. So they're already putting these things in place. We can go quickly to clip number 23 here. The city of San Diego just passed a resolution defining any criticism of Netanyahu, Israel, and Zionism as anti-Semitic. So, like, does Mark Ruffalo understand where this is all going, and that what he said, while not anti-Semitic at all, was considered anti-Semitic, and he has no ability to fight back? This isn't a courtroom where the accused gets a chance to offer a defense, that they just get to decide that you're anti-Semitic and then cut you off from resources. And what a horrifying potential reality this is, and that it's already being put into place with these anti-First Amendment laws being established. But would Mark Ruffalo be against this, or would he only be against this because it's anti-Semitism? Would he be in favor of this if it was you're not allowed to criticize black people because that's racist? You might agree with that. You're not allowed to criticize transgender people because that's transphobic, or Muslim people because that's Islamophobic. I don't know if he'd have a problem with any of those. It's only anti-Semitic. So, again, this is why principle is important. And it's important to understand, like, you need to be against all of this stuff because this is America and we have the First Amendment. And the First Amendment is what allows us to think our own thoughts and come to the truth and actually discuss this stuff in an honest way so we can get out from under the control of these highly coordinated psychopaths. Let's go quickly to clip number 23 here.
Anti-Semitism has been rising in San Diego and across the country. That's according to Jewish organizations and hundreds of speakers at Tuesday's San Diego City Council meeting. Liat Cohen-Reese directs a local anti-Semitism task force. She says defining it is the city's first step to better fight it.
Well, we need language. We need, in order to understand what something is, we need a definition. We need the language.
Nearly everyone who spoke agreed anti-Semitism needs to be combated. They disagreed on how to define it. The city adopted the definition of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, or IHRA. It's been adopted by dozens of countries and cities across the U.S., including Los Angeles, Chula Vista, and El Cajon. It says anti-Semitism is, quote, a certain perception of Jews, which may be expressed as hatred. It includes 11 examples. 7 of them involve the state of Israel. Critics say the language has been used to silence criticism of Israel and support for Palestinians. One of those critics is Jewish council member Sean Elo Rivera. He says people must be allowed to both love Jewish people and speak freely against actions by the Israeli government.
A definition that cannot hold both of these things.
Yeah, that's close. I mean, they should also be allowed to hate Jewish people and the Jewish religion because we have the First Amendment and you don't get to carve out little exceptions for yourself and your people. Everyone should be allowed to love Jewish people. Yeah, absolutely. And not love them. That's your right as an American. So, hey, I'd love Mark Ruffalo to come out and speak out against the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which is the exact concoction that makes his statement anti-Semitic. He criticized Israel. He's an anti-Semite. If he doesn't like that comparison, maybe he can get on board with free speech. Maybe.
Make a massive announcement right now. I mean, this is just bonker town. What it does is just... I feel 20 years younger. I'm not kidding you. Ultra Methylene Blue. Blue.
I know. Blue. I love it. This stuff works, man.
I just can't shut up about it. Up about it. Up about it. Up about it. Ultra Methylene Blue. 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 I mean, this is just bonker town.
I
just can't shut up about it, up about it, up about it. Ultra Methylene Blue, 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 blue. I just can't shut up about it, up about it, up about it, up about it. Get yours now at thealexjonesstore.com. It is just beyond spectacular. I want to make a massive announcement right now. I mean, this is just bonker town. What it does is just... I feel 20 years younger. I'm not kidding you. Ultra Methylene Blue. Blue.
I know. I love it. This stuff works, man.
I just can't shut up about it. Up about it. Up about it. Up about it. Ultra Methylene Blue. 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 I mean, this is just bonker town.
I love it.
I just can't shut up about it. Up about it. Up about it. Ultra Methylene Blue. 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 I just can't shut up about it. Up about it. Up about it. Up about it.
This stuff works, man.
Get yours now at thealexjonesstore.com. It is just beyond spectacular.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle. AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
Now it's time for a real pretty song that Miss Dolly wrote and recorded this number, and it tells about the place where she was born and reared up in East Tennessee. It's called My Tennessee Mountain Home. Make welcome Miss Dolly Parton.
Sitting on the front porch on a summer afternoon, in a straight back chair on two legs, leaned against the wall. On a string and chase the glowing fireflies when evening shadows fall. In my Tennessee mountain home, life is as peaceful as a baby's sigh. In my Tennessee mountain home, we sing in the fields we grew by.
Tribute to Dolly Parton, who passed away today at the age of 80. And yet, represents, Trump has ordered a flag at half staff for 1 week after Dolly Parton's death. I was going to say, there should be, at least in Tennessee, there should be like a holiday or something named after her. Again, just to, if nothing else, just to commemorate a dying aspect of American culture, the true homegrown American icon. That repaid America for the opportunities that he gave her. Dolly Parton, dead at 80. Someone who will never be replaced. Certainly not on the trajectory we're going down. We'll be back on the other side to open up the phone lines for your calls. Stay tuned. Third hour of War Room starts in 90 seconds.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bigley has launched an online pharmacy, 1776rx.health. It's one product we're launching with, my decision, and that is ivermectin with benzidol, both powerful, really good anti-parasitics. It doesn't just get the big worms and all the crap that's out there. It's amoebas, it's microplasms. It is so important. These two together, I mean, ivermectin is a Nobel Prize winning for this, but benzidol is the big one. And folks, it isn't just parasites. Just search benzidol studies. Just put that into a search engine and you'll see congressional hearings. You'll see top scientists. You'll see all the studies on what else it does that they don't want you to know about. It's dramatic. So, and you won't know if you had any type of parasitical deal or whatever until you've done this. And a lot of people went there yesterday. A lot of people got it. Very smart move. 1776rx.health.
Darling, is that you?
Why'd you come in here looking like that in your cowboy boots and your painted on jeans? All decked out like a cowboy's dream. Why'd you come in here looking like that?
Do you want me to start now?
Here comes my baby.
All right, welcome back, folks. Third hour of War Room is on. I'm going to open up the phone lines for your calls in this final hour. We'll get to them quick. Still have more to cover. I'm moving on from the Jewish mafia stuff, even though I could keep going. Even though I still have more to talk about in that regard. We'll move on because there's some other pretty interesting stories to talk about. But we'll be taking your calls about any and all topics, whatever you want to call in about. The number to dial, 512-266-0642. That's 512-266-0642. We are now taking your calls here on the War Room. Of course, you're watching us live Tuesday, the 25th of August. It is 5:07 p.m. So give us a call, 512-266-0642. Lines are now open. So we cover this first from Mickey Willis on X. Vaccine researcher Paul Thorsen expected to plead guilty. Paul Thorsen, one of the key scientists whose research is used to prove that vaccines did not cause autism or do not cause autism, has been charged with 22 counts of fraud, including falsifying reports on vaccines. According to published reports, Danish vaccine researcher Paul Thorsen will plead guilty on September 1st, 2026, to federal charges that he stole over $1 million in grant funding that he received from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Thorsen is accused of using Center for Disease Control and Prevention money earmarked for autism research for his own purposes. The Danish-born researcher was studying the possible link between vaccines and the rise of autism rates. Charges against him raised questions about whether he was deliberately falsifying vaccine data to prove that vaccines do not cause autism and have nothing to do with the rise of autism in the United States. According to the author and investigator James Otar Grundvig, Thorsen's guilty plea is a huge victory for justice in the generation-long controversy, he continued. CDC hired mercenary scientists here and abroad to cook data on MMR and thimerosal studies to erase the autism signals in vaccine research. They were desperate to keep the trust in the myth that vaccines are quote-unquote safe and effective. According to U.S. Attorney Hertzberg, the charges and other information presented in court from 2000 to 2009, the CDC Division of Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities awarded over $11 million to two governmental agencies in Denmark to study the relationship between autism and exposure to vaccines, between cerebral palsy and infection during pregnancy, and between childhood development and fetal alcohol exposure. In 2002, Thorsen, who had worked as a visiting scientist at the CDC when he was soliciting the grant application, became responsible for administering the research money to the CDC. Thorsen allegedly stole more than $1 million of the CDC grant money by submitting fraudulent documents to the Danish government, Aarhus University, and a Danish hospital where scientists performed research under the grant. From February 2004 to June 2008, Thorsen allegedly submitted over a dozen fraudulent invoices containing the forged signature of a CDC laboratory section chief that falsely claimed the CDC laboratory had performed work and was owed grant money. Which is something that you don't ever see that the other way around. You don't ever see people, falsifying reports to show that it does cause autism, because you don't need to, because they do. That's my interpretation, at least. And again, as we let the phone calls roll in, I'll go to those in just a second. But private equity continues to systematically destroy American life. And this story we've covered ad nauseum very extensively with the Vino mom, Tiffany Cianci, who can be followed on X at the Vino mom. She told us about this at the beginning of this year. We had a very long episode where she talked about this in particular. New York Magazine has finally picked up the story and is reporting it. They say this, travel sports, a term that has come to encompass all sorts of private teams, leagues, and clubs, used to be for the truly exceptional young athlete. Now they're for anyone willing to pay. An expensive, exhausting commitment that has become popular not necessarily because millions of parents want them for their children, but because it can feel like there's no other choice. Recreational programs are underfunded and struggle to compete with for-profit leagues in a prime field, rink, and court times. And the level of play is diluted, often very early, as travel teams are incentivized to enroll children at young ages. Around 5 million children in the U.S. now compete on traveling teams. Parents find themselves trapped. They know the benefits of sports and want that for their children, yet giving it to them often means buying into a sports ecosystem that's inherently flawed. As the pay-to-play model increasingly takes hold, so does the idea that kids should start competing at younger and younger ages, risking the sense of self along with their shoulders and ACLs. And basically, it's the pay-to-play childhood. And it's entirely because of private equity. Because private equity, as, you know, Tiffany Cianci explained when we went over this, they identify certain industries that people are, like, habitualized to participating in. To where if you want your kid to get a scholarship, he's got to play sports. If you want your kid to have the same experience growing up that you did, you got to get him on a little league team. And this, and so they identify, like, you really got to understand how sick this is. They literally identify and focus on things that are like traditions or necessary for your future development. And then they buy those out and start tacking on fees and start adding on qualifications or prerequisites where you can't just, you know, use your old helmet. You got to buy this specific helmet from this specific store for this specific amount of money. And it's all super overcharged because they know that parents don't have any other choice because they systematically buy up all of them. So it's not like you can go to the non-private equity owned cheap, you know, little league. It doesn't exist. Carrie Corrigan wrote this with the note, burn private equity to the ground. Investors saw an opportunity and had a model. In 2014, a pair of private equity firms acquired Varsity Brands, a team sports apparel and competitive cheer company, for $1.5 billion. The deal gave Varsity Brands ubiquity in the youth sports ecosystem at the national level. From the competitions themselves to the uniforms and training camps, just 4 years later, it was bought by another private equity firm, Bain Capital, for a reported $2.5 billion. In 2024, it was sold to KKR for around $4.5 billion. Travel sports had been growing in popularity since the early aughts, but investment tended to be small and fragmented. A team here, a rink there. This new mentality was bigger and more straightforward. Own it all. Private investment firms began buying up teams, facilities, software, camps, apparel, and media streaming in a roll-up strategy that allows them to profit from almost every aspect of a family's participation. It's a stay-to-play mentality where you go to a tournament that's owned by the same company that owns the team and then says you have to book a hotel block that's owned by the team through a platform also owned by a team. They have rules about taking your own video because they want to sell you their media package, and you have to pay to park because they own that too, said a former club lacrosse coach in New Jersey who has had three children on travel teams. Before you know it, you're paying a lot of money for the privilege of your kid playing a team from one town over, several states away from where you all live. Private equity didn't create these practices, but in some cases it accelerated them, said Tom Ferry, founder and director of the Aspen Institute's Sports and Society Program. And again, just this part alone, they have rules about taking your own video because they want to sell you their media package. This alone tells you everything that it's about, right? Who does this? Because we talked about this with Tiffany Cianci. They will literally kick your kid off the team if you take photos of them playing a game. Do you understand what I just said? If you take your own photos or your own videos of your own child playing a sport, they will kick your kid off the team because they want to force you to pay $100 for their media package where you get a you know, prepackaged production of your kid's sport experience. Obviously, they're not interested in the customer's well-being. Obviously, they're not interested in improving the, you know, experience of the companies that they purchase. It is literally about just ruthlessly and heartlessly extracting the most amount of money you can from people that you yourself put in this vulnerable state where you are, you know, requiring them to fork out thousands of dollars just to get your kid on a little league team, do what you did growing up. They'll get them young too. You got to get them in that pipeline young. So again, it's the type of thing. It's just like, why do we allow this? Why do we allow this? Why do we allow private equity firms to buy up sports, children's sports leagues, and then tack on fees to the parking and the taking a picture of your own kid and the uniforms, and you got to, you know, rent the right field, and that's going to cost you money, and it's just pure unadulterated exploitation. And yet it's somehow legal. Somehow they're allowed to do this. They're allowed to monopolize. They're allowed to form these trusts. They're allowed to build out these networks, contract out with other corporations. There's absolutely no justification in this. At the bare minimum, you would think the justification would be, well, if you get access to this gigantic fund worth of money, if you now have BlackRock and Vanguard sitting on top of your company, they can pour resources into it and they could improve the system, and having a nationwide system, they could sort of normalize things and create systems that serve the customer. But they're obviously not doing that. You don't even have that excuse to make. You can't even say, well, they improved the way the thing operated. They are not improving anything. They literally are just making it worse and more expensive, and they own all of it. Why do we allow this? Where is our Teddy Roosevelt to bust the trust, just put their foot down and say, we're not allowing this because we're not allowing it. We're not allowing it because we don't want it, because it's not good, because it does nothing but fill the pockets of people who are already multi-billionaires. So why would we want this? We don't want it. We're not allowing it. No more argument necessary, right? Will it ever happen? Of course not. Donald Trump is in the pocket of the private equity, and so is the left. So that's where we're at. Let's go to the calls now. It looks like we've got Sean in California first about Dolly Parton. Go ahead, Sean. You're on the air.
Yeah, Harrison, you just amazed me with the coverage of the corruption of youth sports. That's a topic for another day, but you might want to do some deep diving on that. You'd be surprised.
Well, if you want to find out more, search here. I'll find it on X and I'll retweet it. But Tiffany Cianci and I did a very thorough hour on this a couple months ago. So if you want to find out more, I'll find that video and retweet it. But yeah, it's happening everywhere. And youth sports is just one instance. It just happens to be a particular. It's like a pressure point that they've identified. Because American people just like, you just sort of do it and you don't really ask questions, right? You're just like, okay, I want my kid on a little league team. How much does it cost? And then you learn, it's like, oh, it's $500 plus $500 more dollars and all this other crap. And you just sort of go, well, I want my kid to play sports. I guess this is how expensive it is. It's just sick exploitation. But yeah, I'll retweet that video. Thank you for that. But what'd you actually call in about?
So yeah, with Dolly Parton, I wanted to, you know, note something where we're at, because you know, it's sad that she's passed. And there was also a video that was going around on my social media that was viral that I caught, where it showed the red carpet 1990s, you know, for the Academy Awards, and everybody looks healthy and vital and normal. And you know, it's not even like the old school Hollywood of Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin. We're talking when Julia Roberts and Gina Davis, and like, people just looked natural and healthy, and you didn't have the Ariana Grande emaciated people, the ugly socialist template. Well, Dolly, she harkens back to that, to the whole voluptuous blonde. And you know, the thing with that is, when we know who's controlling Hollywood, this and that, someone who looks all Americana like Dolly, oh, well, she can look good for the West, but she has to be a little bit ditzy. That's got to be her persona, or we won't see you on TV. And that's, you know, just the subtle way the door is opening is we have.
But isn't it? But that's. But I agree. But that's why I love Dolly Parton, is because she was clearly sharp as a whip. I mean, you watch her in any interview, she was not stupid at all. So she was able to sort of be the blonde bimbo looking woman, but she had a steel trap for a mind. So she sort of broke those stereotypes in a lot of ways. But I get what you're saying, that she did sort of play into the stereotype, as it were.
Exactly. And that's the reason why, you know, like, she won over Johnny Carson and Jay Leno and other people who would have her as a guest, because they realized, oh, wait, we're not dealing with just another Hollywood cutout.
Yep.
This is someone who's actually from Tennessee and not a, you know, not seeking to be a famous for the sake of being famous. I'm here in California. If you know how many people out here are in this state because they just want to be famous, and it's a sad sickness to see. And that leaves them open to suggestion from an industry that tells them to emaciate themselves, mutilate their gender, or, you know, bow down the knee of political correctness, or you don't get this part.
100%.
There's a lot of work we got to do out here in California to get this state going red, but we got to fix this mindset of fame for the sake of fame.
Absolutely. And, you know, your point about looking at the 90s, and at least people were healthy. At least they looked natural. And now, I mean, what is that, Bill Hicks? That looks like Bill Hicks on her arm, doesn't it? On the right? It's not, but it looked like him for a second. But, you know, we learned during the P. Diddy trial, and it's, you know, it's a regular thing, but one of the people that was talking to Diddy, explained that he was told, we choose people that are untalented on purpose because then we can control them. Because if you get a really talented person and you sign them, if you don't treat them right, they can take that talent somewhere else. If instead all of their talent is an illusion that you produce, then who else? They can't go to anybody else. They have to stick with you because you're actually the one with the talent. They're just the face playing the part. Dolly Parton was a talented woman. Like, she actually wrote those songs. She actually played those songs. So in that way as well, she sort of broke the mold. And I'm sure that gave her leverage in Hollywood, where, you know, if she was just a face, if she was just a person in the front, but really she was untalented and all this stuff was going on in the background to make her popular, then they would control her. But the fact is that she was the moneymaker. She was the genius. She was the songwriter and performer that they actually had to try to win over rather than, like, keep enslaved. So, again, I sort of I can't think of anybody like that right now. I mean, I don't know any young people that are, like, songwriting geniuses. Although Taylor Swift is pretty good, I have to admit. Her songwriting, her lyrics, are actually deeper than I think people give her credit for. But she's obviously no Dolly Parton, not anywhere close. But thank you for the call, Sean. I appreciate it. And, y'all, I'm finding that private equity video to retweet right now. We've done a few, so I gotta find the right one. Let's go to Friendly in, FEMA Region 5 on the woman question. Go ahead, Friendly. You're on the air.
Hey, Harrison. It has been a remarkably terrible couple weeks for women on the internet, and I'd like to provide maybe a little bit of wisdom about how we can get out of this.
Okay.
So women are moon, men are sun. The moon does not create its own light. It can only reflect the light of the sun. Our duty as men is to shine brightly so that we may inspire women, and then they can reflect that light onto us, our children, and the world. Women are like water in a river. Men are the banks of the river. Women are this powerful, beautiful, potentially destructive force that can bring life and nourishment to the world. The job of men is to guide them and to be strong and resist their erosion. Because if the banks are eroded, they turn into a destructive force, right? In chess, the king is the most important piece, but he can only move one space in any direction. But without him, you lose the game. The queen is the most powerful piece because it can move as many spaces as she wants in any direction that she wants. But she does that, and as such, she becomes the king's most powerful agent because she is inspired by his sovereignty, and she is inspired by his light. And I understand that a lot of men are very bitter at women right now, and they have every reason to be. But women do not possess agency, and they will not take responsibility. It is our duty to save them and be good stewards of them. And if you're waiting on a thank you or an apology or a you were right, you're going to be waiting for a very long time. So we can view all of these things that women are doing right now, but just like if your dog poops in the house, are you just going to seethe with resentment your whole life? No, you grab him up, you put his nose in it, and you say, no, you do that outside. And then you put him outside. Because ultimately, it was your responsibility to let the dog out. So the mess that you clean up is the product of your choice. Mm. Women are not going to, they are not the initiators. They're not going to fix this. We fix this. Period. We must restore the hierarchy of natural law. And to do that, we must understand the natural law of polarity. Because if we don't, and it's important to talk about feminism and, you know, the Frankfurt School and the 19th Amendment and blah, 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 but those are symptoms. Those are not the root cause. We must address the root cause or we won't fix the problem.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I mostly agree with you, although I can hear the screeching from the ladies in the audience already. But in a lot of ways, yeah, I mean, men have sort of abdicated their response or their responsibility, rather. And I mean, it really does go down to just like taking advantage of what are actually women's strengths, right? It actually is a strength that women are more amenable to, you know, diversity in a lot of ways. It's actually a strength that they're more patient in a lot of ways with children. And again, just like everybody, I mean, this stuff is not like particularly confusing if you like have children. If you just have children, it's really everything. It becomes very simple. It's just like, it's funny that you say that about you. I was literally teaching my son chess yesterday and said that exact thing where it's like, well, the king is the most important, but the queen is the most powerful. And my wife was just like, you know, just like in real life. And it's like, yeah, there's something to that. There really is. And I'll tell you that for me, the upshot for this entire, you know, saga with Lindsey Clancy and all this has not been to, you know, cause me to be resentful or hateful towards women. It's just reminded me how incredibly amazing it is when you have a good woman. It's just like, oh my God, you know, it's just one of these things where like you can take it for granted for a while. And then you see how insane a lot of women are. And you're like, I really need to buy my wife flowers on the way. I really need to show a little bit more appreciation for what I have because good Lord, there are some crazies out there. And of course, just today, there's an article. This woman, Lindsey Clancy reporter, sparks backlash for grinning at camera, forcing Vanity Fair to pull her credentials. She's literally at a murder trial, like grinning and smiling and giggling. And Vanity Fair is like, yeah, you can't be our reporter anymore. Yeah, look, the whole thing is, I see it like everything else, where it's like, we still need to resist the opposite impulse, right? Just like with racism or anti-Semitism or anything else, this stuff becomes a problem. The feminist programming becomes a problem. And a lot of people's response is to start hating women, just like a lot of people's response to the anti-white activity in America is to start hating non-white people. And it's like, actually, we had it going pretty well for a while. It's called Christianity. It actually values women, but also doesn't hate men. So there's that.
My fellow patriots, the first thing the globalists and the leftists do when they want to silence you is go after your merchant accounts. Go after your business payment systems. It's that simple. They try to cut off your ability to even receive money or make payments. It's globalist siege. It's globalist economic warfare. It's a globalist blockade, an embargo, sanctions against American populist patriots. For everyone that's been watching and listening to me for years, you've seen the attacks. You've seen the deplatforming. You've seen the court battles, the news articles, the demonization, the bogus default judgments. We even have FBI and CIA operatives on hidden camera talking about how their entire goal was to take me out of the knees by knocking out my ability to accept payments. And that model they used on me, they admit, is for all of you.
Alex Jones.
Yeah, so we were after him.
So with Alex Jones, and the goal with him was what, just to bankrupt him?
Pretty much.
Well, because of First United Payments and your support, they failed. And they failed because I had a processor with a backbone who loves America and believes in the free market. One who stands up for American justice and who didn't back down when they received threatening messages and pressure from other major institutions. If you are a conservative business owner, Google is watching you. Meta, Facebook is watching you. Amazon, all of the major big tech is watching you. If you think for one second that they are not orchestrating and coordinating their efforts behind the scenes to take you offline and out of business and render you harmless to the system and the machine, you are wrong. The question is not if, it's when Stripe, Shopify, PayPal, Square, they're all part of the same big tech machine. Consolidation, vertical integration, that is the goal of the BlackRock globalist system. Because once there's only one central system, they can bring in the universal credit score. This is the key to their entire panopticonic takeover plan in their own words. The head of BlackRock, Larry Fink, was very clear. Once they have the system in place and they're close, they are going to shut down everybody that isn't part of their system, even people that aren't political. This is about total control. They've just got to get to the patriots that are opposing them to get to you. And FirstUnitedPayments.com stands directly in the tyrant's way. My fellow Americans, this is your call to action. Call or email First United Payments now and ask them how you can protect your business against the globalist predatory attacks and shutdowns today. Visit First United Payments now at FirstUnitedPayments.com and talk to a real human here in the good old U.S. of A. by calling toll-free 877-899-1313. That's 877-899-1313. The tyrants are counting on us not to innovate. They're counting on us not to migrate to institutions and organizations that are pro-human just like us. This isn't some new company. I've been using them for almost a decade. They're already taking care of most of the patriots. Whether you're a florist, have a gas station, or you're a farmer, or you've got a little five and dime shop or a factory, whatever it is, online merchants, this is the place for you. These guys are patriots and they're in our corner. They're Americans just like us and they hate the New World Order with a passion. They believe in the free market and they understand this is 1776 2.0. 90% of it is information warfare and financial. And this is just as important as the right to self-defense and guns. You've got to be able to have your own business. You've got to be able to operate without these globalist sharks, this mafia shutting you down. And First United Payments is the tip of the spear. Proven warriors, ladies and gentlemen, in this fight. Thank you so much. Now visit FirstUnitedPayments.com right now.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle. AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
In times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Final segment of War Room Live. Taking your calls, the number to dial is 512-266-0642. That's 512-266-0642. Taking your calls now. We've got Duke in Oklahoma. Let's go to Duke. Thanks for calling in, Duke. You're on the air.
Well, is this a Dolly Parton call-in show, or can I talk about anything I want?
You can talk about anything you want, brother.
How you doing, Harrison?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I just wanted to bring up a couple things from the past. Columbine High School shooting and Killdozer in Colorado. I was a part of both events. The bombs that I found doing the earthwork for the annex for Columbine, I found 2 to 3 days before the shooting.
Whoa.
Go ahead.
I had not heard that. That's crazy. So what was your role?
We did the earthwork. I worked for a company called Fiore and Sons, and we were doing the earthwork for the new annexes on the high school grounds on the north side of the high school before all this took place. And there's a little creek that ran alongside the north side of the high school before the neighborhood. And as we were down there grading that area for the build, the cleanup on the sides, I noticed the some odd stuff laying around around the creek bed where the high grass was. Two of them were propane tanks with nuts and bolts and all kinds of stuff welded, JB welded to them. And there were some bags of clothes, looked like trench coats and stuff like that, just to the west of that. I was taken off that job after I had told my supervisor. They took me off that job, sent me all the way across Denver to the other side of Denver, and then 2 days later is when the shooting happened.
Whoa, that is crazy. Yeah, and in case people don't know, the Columbine shooters did have homemade bombs that I guess didn't work, although I think maybe in the beginning they were like throwing sort of smaller hand grenades. You probably know the details better than I do, but certainly like homemade improvised bombs are an acknowledged part of what happened during Columbine. Luckily, they didn't go off, but you found basically proof of this, because I believe it was propane tanks that they were trying to rig up to explode, and you found those 2 or 3 days before the shooting happened.
Yes, and they were never reported. That was never reported. I reported it to my supervisor. That was the last I heard of it until I heard of the shooting at the school. And from there, I moved out of downtown around Denver area, and I moved up to Grand Lake, where I got on with a company called Mountain Park Concrete. Worked a couple jobs up there. That was a resort town. That's where I met Marvin Hiedemeyer, a.k.a. known as Killdozer. We were all pretty much locals around there that knew each other. I worked for the very company that he ended up having the issues with. Cody Docheffi was the owner of the business. We gave away what's never been explained before is Cody was giving away free concrete to the city council members so that they would close the access road off to Mountain Park, Marvin Hiedemeyer's shop. Okay, so they ended up getting away with that. They closed the road off. Then he had applied. The reason why he bought the bulldozer is because he had applied for a permit to bring a new access road off of the highway onto there so he could reopen his business.
Right.
He had a petition started. We all are on the signatures of the petition. I was there when we gave the free concrete to the city council members. I was part of that. I did have a couple incidences that happened where I was almost killed, two times during this whole thing. I was ignorant of the situation. I did not understand the depth of what was going on, but they all knew about me because I was part of both parties. So, I just thought I'd like to get some information out, shed a little bit of light on there. And I'm not giving you all the details on the Marvin Hiedemeyer deal, but, he was a stand-up guy that took on the government by himself, and of course, we all know what happened then.
Yeah, and but luckily, he didn't really even hurt anybody, right? It was mostly all just property damage, which is why so many people are, you know, sort of celebrate Bulldozer unironically and without qualification, because he took revenge against the you know property of the people that screwed him over. Didn't kill anybody, didn't hurt anybody, killed himself, of course, unfortunately.
He would give you the shirt off of his back. I know that he gave a lot of women that had troubles with not having a husband or didn't have the money. He would actually do work on their cars and told them just to pay him when they could get a chance to pay him.
Yeah.
He was an upstanding guy. He was a straight up guy. He was no BSer. And, he would give you the shirt off his back in the middle of a winter storm is the kind of guy he was.
And, sometimes good men get pushed too far and, that's what happens, man. The footage of this is crazy. But back to the Columbine thing. Have you ever talked about this to anybody? Did you ever go to the media or the authorities with what you knew?
I've tried to get a hold of you guys. I've talked to a few people in the background, and they kept telling me to get a hold of Robert Barnes. I tried to get a hold of Robert Barnes, and gave him a phone call and left a couple of messages. Nobody has ever contacted me about what my involvement with the events were.
Now, was it a surprise to you when you got moved over to the other side of Denver? Like, did that make you suspicious, or was that sort of normal and you didn't think about it at the time?
No, it was, they took me off the job. I had just started the job. So I'd been there one day before I had found, propane tanks and the trench coats that were bagged up into some tall grass. And then I just figured they would come out and look at it and figure out what they needed to do with it. Maybe call, the fire department or somebody to come out and check them out. And whenever they said, well, we're going to send you all the way across town to another highway construction job. Yeah, that was totally out of the realm. And they had me doing stuff that week that I had never done before, was not even trained to do, which was odd because they pulled me off of something that I knew what to do to something that I didn't know what to do. And then a week later I was fired.
Whoa. Okay. Yeah. That is very suspicious because again, sort of playing devil's advocate here, or, you know, obviously in retrospect, you know what happened later. So now, you know, those propane tanks take on a whole new element of importance. Yeah. So here's this from the Wikipedia: 15 propane tanks converted to bombs, five of which were 20 pounds, 9 kg or more. So in addition to the firearms, the complex and highly planned attack involved several improvised explosive devices. Harris and Klebold constructed a total of 99 bombs. So, you know, I could see how, like, before Columbine happened, nobody knows it's going to happen. You find propane tanks that, and even if they look like they're made into bombs, I could even see, you know, well, these kids around here, they like to do stuff like this. And, you know, I've made my own, whatever, improvised explosives as a kid. You get bored sometimes. That's what you do. So, you know, if they just sort of write it off and go, oh, well, it looks like some kids were messing around with some dangerous stuff here, that would be one thing. But the fact they take you off the job and send you to the other side of the city to do something else that you've never done before, that is extremely, that reeks of a cover up. That reeks of, you know, get the guy out of here. He got too close to the truth. So that is very, because again, if they just treated it normally, I'd say, well, you know, you saw something that you didn't know was evidence at the time that you only knew in retrospect was, you know, related to the shooting. But if they're taking proactive measures to get you out of the way, that I think is evidence of something. Was your company tied in with the local city? Do you know, or how was, what was the reaction when you reported finding the propane tanks?
And call for a supervisor. A supervisor showed up. I walked him down to where the propane tanks were. And then there were, like I said, there were some bags and some clothing up a little higher into the trees. And he acted a little strange, but he didn't really say a whole lot. And then he left and went and got in his truck and made a phone call. And then when he came back, he told me that, they were just going to send me over completely across Denver on the other side, because the Columbine is right there at the foothills. I was actually sent about 12 to 15 miles away to another job, like I said, that I had no experience on. They had me doing things that I'd never done before. And like I said, a week later, of course, I was let go. And there was no reason for me to let go other than they said that they just didn't need me at that time, which was, that was even more strange to me because they were hiring whenever I got the job there. They needed people for these projects. But yes, they did projects for the city. They did state highway construction. So yes, they were involved with city.
And how close were the propane tanks that you found to the actual school? Because you were there actually helping to grade the land in preparation for building the annex to the school, right? So I mean, were these bombs close enough that it would have damaged the school, or just sort of on school grounds?
Well, if it was on school grounds, they were the annex was around 60 yards, maybe 80 yards from the school. If there would have been anybody walking, and that was a field at that time, they used to all walk through there and play through there. If that was a field, if somebody had been walking through there and those bombs would have went off, yes, it would have injured somebody, and most likely would have caught the houses on fire that were behind it, because the houses had a fence. Right below that fence was the creek, and then a little tree line, and then right that little hill right there went up. That's what we were leveling for the new build on the new annex.
Wow. Well, that is very interesting. I mean, that's very suspicious. And if anybody who's studied Columbine knows that there are still some very wide open questions about that whole event and tapes that have never been released to the public and conspiracies about MK Ultra and psychiatry and all this sort of stuff. So that really adds a super interesting wrinkle to the whole situation. I want to go to more callers, but I feel like, can you stay on the line and give your information to the crew? Cause I want Alex to see this and I don't know what he is going to make of it, but I've never heard this story before. Obviously you've never told it to anybody.
No,
that's totally fascinating. And, I did not expect to be hearing novel information about the Columbine massacre here in 2026, but, it just goes to show you how incomplete our knowledge about these events are. That is super interesting. So stay on the line and my producer will get your information. Anything else you want to say about Killdozer while we have you?
Marvin Heidemeyer was a hero. He was a straight-up guy. He was probably one of the best guys I've ever met in my life. He would do anything for anybody. He never wanted to hurt anybody. And I was part of that whole event without knowing what was really going on intel. I did go to the bathroom one time at the shop whenever we were out there working in the middle of the yard, and he was really skittish. I'll never forget the look on his face whenever I walked by the dozer. The door was closed. I had went in the side door, and I told him I was going to go use the bathroom, and I could never forget his eyes whenever I went in there. He wanted to say something, but he didn't. I could feel that, and when I walked by the dozer, I saw all the welding he was doing to the dozer. He was boxing in the windows. It didn't make sense to me. I didn't understand. Like I said, I was not aware of what all was all going on. I was a part of it, right in the middle of it. I just didn't understand. And then I came back out. I worked for the guy that he was having all these problems with, but I was Marvin's friend. So it was just a crazy deal. I'll never forget the way he looked at me when I went in there to use the bathroom and saw that dozer. And I didn't say anything about it. I never said anything to anybody else about it because I didn't know what he was doing. I just know it was a dozer, and he was a welder. So it wasn't something that I talked about or anything like that. I just now after the fact, it really just sticks in my mind. It just, wow. I can see it.
Yeah, I know, because I know he sort of kept the bulldozer and for months was working on it in the garage, and people were sort of wondering how could he do all this work without anybody knowing, but you know, to you, you actually saw the Killdozer before it was fully prepared and you didn't really think it was anything suspicious. I guess just because he was such a good guy and you didn't, you know, it's not like you're like suspicious of this guy and whoa, what's he up to? It was just normal to you, but you didn't really understand it, but you know, you couldn't have guessed what he was preparing for. That is absolutely fascinating.
No, I couldn't have guessed it. There was no way I could have guessed what was going on. I just knew it was odd. It was a big plate welded on the driver's side of the dozer to box it in. I thought, well, that's going to be awful hot, but went and did my business and came back and then started putting things together after they had aired up the tires on my four-wheel drive so hard on the back end that when I went down the mountain to leave one day, my truck flipped over. It literally blew a tire out and flipped. Well, I didn't know if that was me or the road or the truck or something like that. But the next thing that happened is they sent me on a load with a concrete load on a mixer truck, which we have never ever miscalculated our concrete pours. They sent me on a load way up at the top of a mountain. And when I got there and waited to offload that cement, they said they didn't need it, that they had made the wrong guesstimate on how many yards they needed. On the way back down that road, plus I was not in my original truck, which we were all assigned a truck. On the way down that mountain, those brakes went out. At the end of that mountain road, you either went left or you went right or you went off of a 150-foot cliff.
Right.
And I was on the CB radio the whole time with my heel on my air brakes, my toes on the throttle wide open, trying to get it to get out of gear to get back into a lower gear. And just by God's intervention, not letting off that brake, those pads heated up enough, less than a block from the cliff, those brakes heated up, and that truck slowed down enough to where I could get it into a lower gear. Once I started getting it in lower gears, it started slowing down. I got that sucker pulled over, and I got out of the truck, and of course, you know, That's just, I didn't understand that those things, that I was involved in the middle of these things at the time that I was involved in them.
But so do you think you were an accidental victim of sabotage?
Absolutely, 100%. Now that I think back about how people were treating me after the Marvin Hedemeyer thing was going on, and I was the third name on the petition that Marvin Hedemeyer brought to my buddy's mom's Texaco gas station at the corner in Granby, Colorado. He brought the petition in, asked if we could leave it up there to get the locals to sign it, because we were all locals. And we said, of course. She signed it. Shane, my buddy, signed it. I signed it. And, of course, he obviously got a hold of those signatures somehow in the middle of that stuff and found my name on it. But I was working for him. They didn't give me my Christmas bonus, which was unheard of. I was one of the top drivers. I was probably one of the top 100 drivers in the United States, operators. And it took time, Harrison, for me to understand what had transpired and what my role in the parts, the things that were going on around. It took me time to figure out that I was targeted, and I was.
Wow. That is absolutely fascinating. So you were working for the guy who Killdozer was enemies with and was sort of fighting in the courts, and your boss learned that you had written your name on the petition for his enemy, and suddenly your brakes go out while you're going downhill on a truck that he owns. That is hugely suspicious. I'm sorry to all other callers, but I had to keep Duke on. This is one of the most fascinating calls we've ever gotten. Stay on the line. My producers will get your information. And I'm gonna show this to Alex, and you know, maybe we'll have you on again to talk about this, because that, like I said, it's not very often you get new information about a 30-year-old series of crimes, but I had never heard either one of those things. So thank you so much for calling, Duke, and stay on the line, and crew, if you can just get his information so we can call him back when we need to. That is totally fascinating. Thank you for that. Now I'm gonna go to more calls here in just a second, but I do want to tell you folks, if you want to support us, if you want to keep us on the air, if you want to keep this extremely unique format that we have, the 3-hour shows, the call-ins, I mean, nobody else does this online. It's us, and then you got the mainstream media spewing BS endlessly, and then you've got sort of the streamers not holding themselves to as high of a standard as we do. If you like having a program that can cover all this stuff, cover the waterfront, give you the breaking news and the story behind it, and occasionally dip our feet in recent American history, or hell, I can even spend a segment talking about ancient history if I think it applies to what's going on today. And that is really a blessing of having this incredible, diverse and intelligent audience that will sort of go with us. You know, not a lot of other shows will spend an entire segment talking about Killdozer and Columbine on a whim, but that's literally what we're here for. And without us, there's really nothing like us. So please keep us on the air. Keep us in the fight. We are expanding. This is a fundraising time for us. TheAlexJonesStore.com is the best way to support us, really the only way to support us monetarily. TheAlexJonesStore.com. Make a purchase there. No matter what you purchase, you are getting a free bottle of Shilajit gummies. And we just think you're going to like them so much, you're going to want more. It's sort of first one free type of thing, because once you try these Shilajit gummies, you're honestly going to want more. However, the quantities are limited, so this only lasts while supplies last. You've got to go now. TheAlexJonesStore.com. No matter what you order, whatever price, whatever product, doesn't matter, whatever you order, you're getting a free bottle of Shilajit gummies in the box with what you order, and you're going to love it all. So please go now. TheAlexJonesStore.com. Take advantage of that offer and get yourself a absolutely free bottle of Shilajit gummies, which are, of course, one of my favorite products of the store ever since we came out. Shilajit and Irish Sea Moss, those have just remained my go-to. I take the other stuff that we come out with as well, but the Shilajit and the Irish Sea Moss, you cannot go wrong with. And Shilajit is really powerful stuff. So get it now, TheAlexJonesStore.com. I know we got time for at least one more call. We'll go to Dale in North Carolina. Thanks for calling in and holding. Dale, you're on the air.
Hi, Harrison.
Howdy.
There's a point I want to make about, I guess you guys are still in like the growing stage or something, but some of your commercials are just blowing my eardrums out. I've tried to call several different people and even text people. some of your commercials are just so loud that they blow your eardrums out.
It's too loud, huh?
Way too loud. You for a while it was, you could barely hear the commercials, the show was good. But now it's like the show is really low, but the commercials come on and they pretty much, you know, stick your earbuds in and they blow your eardrums out.
All right. Well, I haven't noticed that. I usually watch Alex's show and I haven't noticed that myself. How are you listening to the show?
Well, through several different devices I tried, okay? I got a feed from your website that I play through VLC. Then I try the Alex Jones app. Then I go on Rumble with my computer and stuff. The commercials are just, like, way overpowering sometimes.
Well, I'll pass that on. Hopefully we'll get that corrected for you here. Anything else?
Yeah. Yeah, the other thing I wanted to say, you do bring up some good topics. I mean, I like the thing you said the other day about the machine guns. I do like that idea. But
on how to stop migrants getting into Spain, it's an easy solution.
Harrison, no. You carry on too long about the same topic, and you repeat yourself way too much. Other than that, you know, okay, but it's just sometimes you just carry on way too long about the same topic.
Oh, you just repeated yourself, sir, I'll have you know. Okay, well, I appreciate the feedback. You know, the problem is there's so much to talk about with each topic. It's at a certain point, I just got to cut it off, even though I could keep going about certain things. And, repeating myself, you know, I do this extemporaneously, right? It'd be a lot. I would never repeat myself once if we had a teleprompter because I would just be able to say it once. But a lot of times I feel like I'll say something and I'm like, did I get that across? Did that really come through? Or I'm repeating it on purpose because repetition is how it sticks in your brain. And that's just a fact of human communication. So. But I appreciate the input, sir. Going too long on topics. Well, some topics you got to delve into. And we can only get so many in any single show. We got less than a minute left in the show, but let's go quickly to Tim in Wisconsin since he's been holding. Tim, you're on the air. 30 seconds. Go.
Harrison, you're my favorite. I can't get enough of you. You're the best. And I don't know what else I could say.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. This is I'm getting knocked down and built back up again. That was a great antidote to the last caller we just had. A little bit of criticism, a little bit of praise, and I'm right in the middle. Thank you for that. I do appreciate it. And, folks, if you want to support us, you got to go to thealexjonesstore.com and make yourself a purchase. Keep us on the air and in the fight. Thealexjonesstore.com. I do appreciate it. I'm doing my best here, folks. I'm sorry if I repeat myself, but the other thing is, I don't know who's tuning in on any random day. You know, I say something once, and then I don't say it for 6 months, and then I say it again, and nobody's ever heard it. So, you know, unless you're tuning in every single day, you probably won't notice how much I repeat myself. It's all strategic, folks.
My fellow patriots, the first thing the globalists and the leftists do when they want to silence you is go after your merchant accounts, go after your business payment systems. It's that simple. They try to cut off your ability to even receive money or make payments. If you are a conservative business owner, Google is watching you. Meta, Facebook is watching you. Amazon, all of the major big tech is watching you. If you think for 1 second that they are not orchestrating and coordinating their efforts behind the scenes to take you offline and out of business and render you harmless to the system and the machine, you are wrong. The question is not if. It's when Stripe, Shopify, PayPal, Square, they're all part of the same big tech machine. Because once there's only one central system, they can bring in the universal credit score. The head of BlackRock, Larry Fink, was very clear. Once they have the system in place and they're close, they are going to shut down everybody that isn't part of their system. Even people that aren't political. This is about total control. They've just got to get to the patriots that are opposing them to get to you. And FirstUnitedPayments.com stands directly in the tyrant's way. My fellow Americans, this is your call to action. Call or email First United Payments now and ask them how you can protect your business against the globalist predatory attacks and shutdowns today. And talk to a real human here in the good old U.S. of A. by calling toll-free 877-899-1313.
You've got to be able to have your own business. You've got to be able to operate without these globalist sharks, this mafia shutting you down. And First United Payments is the tip of the spear. Proven warriors, ladies and gentlemen, in this fight. Online merchants, this is the place for you. Now visit FirstUnitedPayments.com right now.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle. AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.